Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Movie Geeks United. It's a great pleasure to have everyone here tonight for the final episode in our series celebrating the summer of 1985 at the movies. And tonight, we've saved the best for last. We are covering the behemoth of that summer and, of course, that whole year, Back to the Future, a movie that has survived unlike any other from that year, certainly, and you know, you can take the whole decade of the 80s, and it's representative of you know, movies that have survived from that decade. My name is Jamie, and I'm here with my co-host, Jerry.
Hey, what's up?
How are you?
Do I have to even say anything? You just said a mouthful right there with Back to the Future. I mean, it was the hot tub time machine of its day. No, no, but let's talk about that. Before Back to the Future and its sequels, represent something that we've seen a lot of. You still see it, and I'm going to name, I mean, Hot Tub Time Machine is obviously a lesser movie, but definitely inspired by it. There's no doubt about that. Even something that's even sillier is 17 Again. But this whole idea that you can go back and change things and make things better, it seems to be this really this wish fulfillment, and it has never really died.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it's a Back to the Future thing that you can go back and you can fix things. I mean, it's the ultimate fantasy.
Well, it works on many different levels.
A lot.
First of all, from just a technical filmmaking standpoint, mm-hmm. It's so immaculately crafted and so enjoyable and energetic, and the performances are so infectious. And the concept is ingenious. But when you think about the concept, it is like... it does have cringeworthy elements.
Oh, it does. It does have cringeworthy.
And yet it works as a family kind of film.
It does.
You know?
It does. That it works as well as it does is amazing. But I guess the first one obviously is the best one. I kind of wish they never made sequels to them.
Right.
I like the third one. There are parts of the second one I like. But overall, it's the first one. It's just very ingenious.
Yeah.
The greatest use of the DeLorean ever. I'll tell you, our next-door neighbor had that car, and after the first week, that car was a lawn ornament for 15 years, never moved.
Yeah, yeah. Ingenious movie, and, you know, and it came out, it was 85, so mm-hmm. I wasn't 12 yet, because this opened in June, I believe, of 85. And so I went to see it, and I knew Michael J. Fox, of course, and I knew mm-hmm. that Spielberg was behind it. It easily became one of my favorite movies as soon as I saw it. Just ingenious, this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think – I remember the critical reaction being generally positive.
Yeah.
I don't think it was as enthusiastic as it should have been.
It was actually more enthusiastic than I think you remember, but I know what you mean. But it was the big. You were in a summer where there was. Remember, for the 80s, it was either a Star Wars or an Indiana Jones or an E.T. or something of those natures that dominated the summer, and then and what was it, 84, you had, Temple of Doom. And then what was going to be the big thing? Was it going to be Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome? Maybe. The Goonies, there everyone was hoping, Explorers. But no, it was Back to the Future. It was the movie. The giant.
Yeah,
movie.
And I don't know that expectations were. Sure, it was a Steven Spielberg production.
Mm-hmm.
But Zemeckis had been, he'd made an impression with Used Cars.
And Romancing the Stone.
Right. So he was an up-and-comer.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't necessarily firmly established.
No.
As a blockbuster director. Michael J. Fox, who headlined the movie, comes from TV. This
mm-hmm.
was his first major kind of foray into feature film.
Class of 1984, I remember he was in, and then after that, I think it was a Teen Wolf, is that something, that same summer,
Teen
right?
Teen Wolf was two months later.
Yeah.
It came out.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, and this is obviously decades before Robert Zemeckis discovered the capture animation or whatever that crap is he likes.
Yeah, back when he made good movies.
When he liked to work with actors in the flesh.
Yeah, with full live actors. So the expectations, I don't think, were there necessarily for this to be as big a film as it turned out to be,
mm-hmm.
which is great. So it felt kind of like a discovery for everyone at the same time. So in the previous episodes that we've been playing for the past 2 weeks of the Summer of 85 of the movies, we've talked about Fletch with actress Dana Wheeler-Nicholson. We've talked about Cocoon with Steve Guttenberg, St. Elmo's Fire with Joel Schumacher, Better Off Dead with director Savage Steve Holland, Explorers with Joe Dante, and American Flyers with Alexandra Paul. Tonight, for the finale, in addition to speaking about Back to the Future with Leah Thompson, we're going to talk about everything else that came out that summer, too, with between Jerry and myself, frequent Movie Geeks United contributor Arenada Diaz, and one of our great friends to the show, critic Keith Ulick. And that will be happening at the bottom of the hour, right after this conversation with Leah Thompson. And this was an exciting conversation, because everyone, and I tell her this, we got so many emails and messages when we announced she was going to be on the show. Lots of boyhood crushes there
mm-hmm.
attached
oh, yeah.
to Leah Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
And you really like Some Kind of Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. I think that may be my, it's really funny. That may be my favorite John Hughes movie. That may honestly be my favorite one. And that's because of her and obviously Mary Stuart Masterson, and Eric Stoltz, the man who never ages.
and the man that was originally cast in Back to the Future.
Yeah, so, I do really love Some Kind of Wonderful. It's a great
You know what? We talk about Some Kind of Wonderful. I asked just for you, man.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much.
That's the kind of friend I am.
You are a very good friend.
So here is Leah Thompson, guys, talking about Back to the Future and a whole lot of other things. Enjoy.
Steven Spielberg presents Back to the Future, a Robert Zemeckis film. Marty leads an ordinary life.
No McFly ever amounted to anything in the history of Hill Valley.
Well, history is going to change.
And 1985 is not his year. But Dr. Brown is about to change all that.
Are you telling me you built a time machine? What about DeLorean?
He's sending Marty 30 years back in time.
It works!
It's a flying saucer from outer space!
Now, he's trapped in the past.
It's gotta be a dream.
About to meet...
Chocolate.
...his future father.
He's a baby. Tough.
Wow!
And he's making an impression on his mother.
He's an absolute dream. And he can sleep in my room.
Anything you do could have serious repercussions on future events.
Now, he's got to make his mother and father fall in love.
For crying out loud, I haven't even been born yet.
And only Dr. Brown can help him get back to the future.
Are you telling me that this sucker is nuclear?
Precisely.
Michael J. Fox.
Whoa, this is heavy.
Christopher Lloyd.
There's that word again, heavy.
Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
Back to the Future.
You actually wanted to be a ballerina before you got into movies, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I really wanted to be a ballerina, but I just didn't quite have the right body for it. So luckily, I found acting, which is, I'm sure I was much more successful as an actress than I would have been as a dancer. I think it really helped me. I mean, it really helped me for parts like Back to the Future, just because – people carry themselves differently in different times, and you know, when you have a lot of control over your body, you can change your character a lot, you know.
Did it feel natural to you when you started performing on camera, or did it take a while to kind of get acclimated and find your footing?
Well, you know, I think it's always a learning process. I am still learning, so, you know, and you forget, and then you have to relearn. So, yeah, it's different to go from stage to film and from dance to acting, but, you know, I eventually got it. I made a few mistakes. I'm pretty horrible in Jaws 3D, my first movie.
No,
I remember my brother said, "You have a nice laugh in that." That was the only thing he could say good.
I think it was pretty hard to come off very, very good in Jaws 3D for anyone.
Yeah,
that
it was pretty bad.
But with the Back to the Future opportunity came about for you, how did that come about, and what were your initial thoughts about it?
When I read the script, I thought it was really great. I loved that my part was so I got to be so versatile, and I really understood the characters. You know, I understood the beaten down, unhappy, you know, alcoholic mom. I understood the young, you know, happy, horny girl. And I just understood the characters, and I thought that the story was really amazing. I mean, it was really a great part. And I had done a movie called The Wildlife at Universal, and so they were looking actually at Eric Stoltz, who was in the movie as well, and they saw me, and they were like, "We got to get that girl.
Wow.
Get that girl in here." So I that's how they found me.
And so there was no read or anything like that? They just hired you straight out for the part?
Oh, no. I had to, they put me through the ringer for sure. I had screen tests, and I remember doing a screen test. Well, it wasn't really a screen test. It was a video test, and I remember Steven Spielberg was running the camera, and I was like, wow, is this how Hollywood is all the time? And they put like a shmata on my head, like a little scarf on my head, and a wig to see if I could play the older lady. And it was kind of fun. We were laughing the whole time.
So when you conceive of the character, did you fill it in with your own mother and your own sense of your mother?
No, my mom wasn't like that character at all. No, it's probably like my girlfriend's moms growing up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was never beaten down. No one ever got my mom. She's an amazing person. My mom's like a diva, you know, and a fantastic woman. She's still like painting and writing songs. And,
wow.
At like 83. But I think I was playing some of my girlfriends growing up in Minnesota, their moms, you know, more beaten down. The world did not win with my mother. My mother.
when you're playing it, though, this applies to Back to the Future or anything that you do. Is there usually a moment when you think I've got this, or are you always questioning whether you're playing the right note, so to speak?
I think there are some times when it clicks in, maybe more on stage, but sometimes in film. I did a musical for 8 months, and I could feel it like, boom, when I could get, you know, when I was singing these songs, and I could get the whole audience. It's very exciting. But sometimes, you know, crews on movies are really, they're kind of trained to not react, because they really aren't supposed to laugh or cry or do anything. They're, you know, they're supposed to not be there. So it's kind of a weird thing. But sometimes you can feel when you get the character. And, you know, it's very surprising as an actor. Sometimes you think some character should be really easy for you to do, and it doesn't come at all. There's a little magic that's involved in that. And I did know those characters were very – not that I didn't work really hard on that script, I really worked hard on it, but I knew these characters and I loved them, and but it's not always like that.
So you had actually started the production with Eric Stoltz, and there was reshooting involved when Eric left, wasn't there? How long were you guys into production when that happened?
6 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a big deal. Yeah, 6 weeks in, and so all that had to be reshot. There were a few shots they used. There were some stunts from the, there's a whole skateboarding thing. There's some stunts that they kept, and a couple of close-ups and stuff like that. But most of it had to be reshot, which was really awful.
But when Michael J. Fox came in, was the chemistry automatically there? Did you automatically kind of connect to him?
You know, Michael is a comical genius. You know, I mean, he has a shtick. He you know, from doing the sitcom, he had a lot of tools at his disposal for comedy that, you know, are things that not everybody has. They're not skills that all actors have, and so you know, he was unique and you know, wonderful, and I could tell that the material worked better with him, just because, you know, he knew how to get a laugh all the time. You know, he always he was remarkable that way. I just, Walter Matthau is the only other actor I've ever worked with that, you know, he could make anything funny. Like, when they needed something to be funny, he could find a way.
Yeah, yeah. So when you were shooting it, did you feel like it was something special? Did you know that it was working?
I mean, you know, when you're doing a movie with Steven Spielberg, you're like, oh, okay, you know, it should be special. But he you know, when we were doing it, the story was working so well, the story was so good, that I think we all knew it was something special. And then when we wrapped, they put it into such hyperspace. I mean, they edited it for, I think it was out in 4 weeks or 3 weeks from the time we wrapped. It was in the theater, so we knew that they knew they had something special. But I didn't really believe that it would, you know, you never think that something would still be celebrated 25 years later, and you know, grandchildren would be watching it. I feel really blessed.
That's got to be one of the most satisfying parts of this whole thing for you, because, you know, when I was a teenager, I watched it, and now as an adult, and parents that were my age back then, they're showing their kids. It's a whole generational thing, and it's a great family experience too.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think there's something really deep about it, and I think that Crispin Glover and I, you know, were very, there was a lot of pathos in our performances, and the idea that your parents were people, young people with dreams, and that their lives, you know, that they got dragged under by the undertow of life, and lost their spark, you know, and that the kids, that their own son could bring that spark back is like a beautiful thought, and I think it's resonant, you know. I think it was definitely disguised, the story of friendship and redemption was disguised in this really brilliant, funny time travel story, but there's a lot of depth in the script, which is, you know, a script has to have that kind of depth in order to endure, I think, because it's resonant.
Well, were the next two films, the two sequels, were they similar experiences for you, or were they completely different animals from this first film?
They were completely different because, just because, I think sequels are always problematic that way. But I think, you know, I mean, I also, because they didn't have Crispin Glover in them, it was a little bit harder for me in the sense that I would have less to do. Although the second movie I actually love. I mean,
yes.
And I forget about it. When I've seen it, I'm like, wow, it was like for me as an actress, I got to do so many crazy things. I got to be that boozy broad with the big boobs, and I got to be this crazy old lady, and, you know, and then got to be young again. I mean, it was it really required every bit of my acting chops. But the third one was not as much fun for me. But although, you know, I know that it was for Chris Lloyd, his favorite movie, because he got to kiss a girl. I think it was the only time in his career.
But that was a very unique shooting schedule too, wasn't it? Didn't they do that back to back? There was no break between the second.
Yeah,
and third?
They were just setting out to make the one movie, and the script was long, and I don't remember how far into shooting it was. Not very far. They went, we're going to just expand this and make it two movies. Excuse me. Because they knew they could never come back. Michael wasn't getting any younger, and it was just made sense. So we shot for an entire year, and it was very difficult on Bob Zemeckis.
Mm. Well, I wanted to ask about Mr. Zemeckis real quick. When you watch the movie or the movies, what do you see of Bob Zemeckis in those movies?
Oh, my goodness, I see so much, and it's one of my favorite memories of those movies is just how much joy he had making them. I mean, at least from my perspective, he was always giggling and trying to think of something new to do and some other little bonus treat to give to the audience, and he had such delight in creating those movies. It was a real joy to behold. I just think of him giggling all the time.
Now, do you participate in the, because I know they have fan events for Back to the Future and that sort of thing. Have you participated in any of that? And what are your experiences with Back to the Future, kind of diehard fans?
I do. I have done a few of these things, and it's really lovely. It's really touching how much it means to people, and they bring their families and their grandchildren, and it's a, you know, at first I was like, wow, this is odd, you know, but then I just, you know, there's so much love and fun, and, you know, and Chris Lloyd, I've seen him at a few things, and he just has the best time. People love him so much, and, you know, he's kind of a shy person, and it's really fun to see him interacting with fans and, you know, exchanging all those good vibes, and it's fun. It's fun to have something that's and help keep it alive a little bit. It's amazing how many fans there are out there.
Yeah, this movie has endured like no movie from that decade that I can think of.
Really? Oh, that's sweet.
Oh, it still works just as well as it did the first time you saw it. It does not age. It's timeless.
It's really good. It's really good. I know. The music I love, too.
Mm-hmm.
I just love
mm-hmm.
the music.
Can I ask you just one question about a movie you did after, Some Kind of Wonderful, which is a big favorite of one of our co-hosts on the show. His name's Jerry. And we actually spoke to your husband last year, I think, for our John Hughes tribute.
Oh.
I was wondering if you had any thoughts about the time that you spent with Mr. Hughes. I would think that you guys did interact.
I actually did another movie with him, Dennis the Menace, he produced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John was always a little bit of an enigma, but I remember one thing specifically. He was, you know, he was very serious about his characters. They were very important, and, you know, and that was a great thing, you know, for a young actor to have a real respect for the character. And I remember one time I was shooting Some Kind of Wonderful, and we were at a gas station, and I was in this convertible car or whatever, and John came around, and he goes, "Can I see something?" And he motioned for my purse, and he said, "Can I look at that?" And I said, my prop purse, and I handed it to
uh-huh.
him. And he was looking in there to see if there was paper or if there was real stuff. And luckily I, you know, had put real stuff in there, you know, as my character. I'd imagined things in my purse, you know, just like I did in Back to the Future. I had gotten all kinds of coins from the 50s, and I put them in there, and, you know, I had the right compacts and everything. No one in the audience will ever see it, but it helped me feel more like I was in character. And so thank God I passed that test, the John Hughes purse test. But I I just was always struck by how important the characters were to him, especially in Some Kind of Wonderful, not so much in Dennis the Menace. He was an interesting cat because, you know, you wouldn't talk to him for like 2 years, and then he'd call you and you'd talk to him for like 4 hours.
Mm.
He was really, he was a real honest-to-God genius.
Yeah, yeah. And defined a generation, really. Yeah. I mean, his impact is just enormous. Speaking of your husband, you, who is a great director, you've turned to directing. Tell me about that. Was that what surprised you about yourself in that role of director?
You know what surprises me is I'm not very nice. I'm not like super nice to actors. And I have this real problem with right and left. Like, you know, move a little to the right, move a little to the left. It takes me like 20 minutes to figure out which way is right and left. I don't know what.
So you're actually lacking direction.
I'm lacking direction. So I'm constantly, like, moving people, which is super rude, you know. I'm like, just, you know, and I'm not as, you know, I'm not real touchy-feely as a director to the actors because I am, maybe because I really respect people who, you know, who I hire and
mm-hmm.
I know they're, you know, they don't need a lot of hand-holding, but someday I'll run into an actor who needs some and I'll, or a lot, and I'll, you know, I'll have to really dig deep because that's what surprised me. I thought I'd be more sensitive, but
well, do you direct actors in the way that you like to be directed?
Perhaps, maybe you've just taught me something. maybe, yeah. But I can't tell you how. This is another surprise to me. Is, you know, when you're doing a scene with another actor as an actor, it's, you know, whatever, it's just whatever, and you walk away. But when I'm sitting behind camera and I'm watching two actors, and I'm directing them, when they do something great, I, like, tear up. I'm just, like, so excited. I'm ecstatic about how the scene is going. I'm so proud and, you know, full of just unbridled love.
Yeah.
It's such a great feeling.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you directing something upcoming? I think I saw a credit that you might.
I am trying. It's a little hard time for independent movies. So,
yeah,
you know, the financing kind of starts and falls out and comes back and falls out. So right now I'm playing that kind of roulette with a movie that I want to do. So, but it'll happen. You know, something always happens.
Well, in
but
the meantime, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. But I really love directing. I mean, I love our business. I love any part of it.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, you do have some upcoming projects, don't you?
I do. Well, I did a pilot, which didn't get picked up, but I have a movie called The Convincer coming out, which I think is going to be fantastic. I really do. And it's an independent movie, but I'm, you know, it's just got an amazing cast and Greg Kinnear and Alan Arkin and Bob Balaban and Billy Crudup, and it's a great cast. So I'm really excited about it.
Does that have a release date attached to it yet?
Not quite yet. I'm just looping tomorrow, but I'm absolutely certain these amazing this amazing woman. Directed it and who happens to be my neighbor. I met her because of my cat. That's how I got that job. my cat was flirting with her cats, so I met her. So, a very exciting project. And my daughter is acting. Howie and I's daughter started acting, and I produced a movie called Mayor Cupcake, which should probably be out sometime in the fall.
With Billy Crudup, right?
No, this is a different movie. This is with Judd Nelson.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yes.
No, that's okay. This movie called Mayor Cupcake with Judd Nelson, which is a bizarre kind of circular thing. is that my daughter saying, "Don't you forget about me," to Judd Nelson and I, and that was. We were shooting that the day after John died, so we were just Judd and I were both so overwhelmed just hearing that song, you know, which you really think about him from The Breakfast Club. That song is so powerful from The Breakfast Club.
Wow. Well, these projects sound amazing. And I got to tell you before I let you go, Jamie Nash says hello.
And also,
our listeners have been emailing me nonstop about their excitement in having you involved in this series, because I know you hear this a lot. They all had crushes on you, and they all still have crushes on you. And I think the seeds were planted with Back to the Future, so they're very appreciative of you.
That's so sweet. Thank you so much for telling me that. That means a lot.
Okay, that's our conversation with Leah Thompson about Back to the Future and a lot of other great highlights in her career. I was just chatting with one of our listeners and with Patrick, and he said, "Man, this is a great interview. It sounds very intimate."
It was an awesome interview. I actually kind of teared up a couple of times.
Did you, man?
Yeah, no, I did. And no, not when you mentioned my name either. No, it was very nice. I liked how she, like, there's a level of honesty in her interview and Joel's interview last week, and as that is Steve Hollins, that we don't always hear. You know, there's a level, you know, they're very forthcoming, and she was very forthcoming about things that I would not expect. So,
well, she's been in the business for a long time.
Yeah.
She knows herself, you know, and with Schumacher. What was astounding to me when he said, "Call me back anytime. I'd love to talk about the other movies and even the movies that I ruined."
Yeah, no, that was there's a level of honesty that I really respect.
Yeah,
it was incredible.
So Back to the Future. I guess we're going to start our roundtable discussion now, and I guess we're going to go in order of release, but for continuity's sake. We'll start out with Back to the Future to get everyone's take on Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm.
So to introduce the remaining two members of our panel, let's start out with our good friend, Keith Ulick. He's a terrific friend to the show. He's been on many times, and we always love having him. He is the editor of The House Next Door, which is a fantastic blog about movies. And actually, for the past 2 weeks, I think it continues until Friday, they have been running articles on some of the films from the summer of 1985. We tie in with them every year. We do the series, and they have great writers and contributors who write just wonderful articles. And he is the editor of that website.
Can I say something about The House Next
Can
Door?
I give the website real quick?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. slantmagazine.com/house. We've been promoting it on our Facebook page. Some really exceptional articles on some of these films that we'll be discussing tonight. Go ahead, Jerry. Say your thing.
Whenever I burn out on, you know, because you read so much stuff every couple months on film, on a lot of so many different websites, and you get burn out. The House Next Door always presents a writer, a great writer. I mean, as someone who's a really good writer, and a very refreshing new slant on something. No pun intended on the new hosting site there, but it's just really refreshing every couple months that, you know, just when you think, God, I've had enough of all these, you know, generic opinions, here's The House Next Door with something really unique to throw out there.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's a great website. And, I mean, his reviews that you can find at Time Out New York are also exceptional. And some of the most unique takes you'll find on some of the films out there. Okay, enough. Let's bring him on.
Yeah, bring him on.
Hey, Keith.
Yes, hello.
Hey, man, how are you?
Good, good. How am I coming through, okay?
Yeah,
you're coming through great. Great.
Great, great, yeah. Cool.
All right, let's bring on our fourth panelist, frequent Movie Geeks United contributor.
Home video.
We all know him, we all love him. Mr. Aaron Adidias. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, guys.
Hey,
hey
man.
Keith.
Aaron.
Hey,
Aaron,
Keith.
How you doing?
Good yes, to sir. Hear from you, my man.
Good to hear from you.
Good to hear.
Good to hear.
Me and Keith share a mutual love-hate relationship to Remember Me. So, good.
We'll cover that 25 years from now.
No.
Hey,
oh God. Yeah.
Aaron.
was a big help a couple of months ago. Aaron did an awesome job. We hosted a show back in March, I think, and it was a lot of fun. It was a good show.
Yeah.
Good times. Aaron, hey, tell us about your show tomorrow night, because you are continuing the Summer of 1985 series with your own show, blogtalkradio.com/backbymidnight, right?
Right. It'll be on tomorrow night at, I believe, 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central. And my show, I'm going to kind of turn into an impromptu kind of almost tribute to what I'm thinking about, what might be the most influential and most significant release of the Summer of 85, and that's Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
I think you're right.
Interviewing, I have interviews with E.G. Daily, and I think the most significant contributor to the film, production designer David L. Snyder, who also had won an Oscar for Blade Runner. And as I was watching the film again and doing the interviews, I realized that, you know, that film is probably most significant on probably skewering fantasy filmmaking since 1985, and also probably one of the more important directorial debuts of American commercial filmmaking of the last quarter century. And if you really look at Pee-wee's Big Adventure, there'd be, you can see the lineage from Simpsons, The Family Guy, to Wes Anderson. It's kind of all kind of it's in there. And so, yeah, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And I have my mixed emotions about Burton films. I take them kind of one at a time, but I think even a lot of the Burton haters out there, they really can't. I haven't really heard anyone who said, "Well, I don't like Pee-wee's Big Adventure." Like, that's kind of the one universal one.
You know what's really amazing to me? I just asked you who was on the show tomorrow night.
So, well, hey, let him sell his show, man.
Who's the third guest on your show?
Oh, and the third, and as a postscript, and this was a last-minute deal, filmmaker Martha Coolidge, talking about Real Genius, which came out in the summer of 85, obviously, and she kind of also had an influence on kind of doing, you know, smart, sexy teen films with that and Valley Girl.
Yeah. So that's on at, what time are you airing tomorrow night live?
Looks like 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central.
blogtalkradio.com/backbymidnight, 10 p.m. Eastern, or Eastern? Is that what you said?
10 p.m. Eastern.
Tomorrow night.
Yeah.
Okay. Anytime afterwards, available for replay. Okay, we just got done talking to Leah Thompson about Back to the Future. So let's start, and let me get you guys' feelings on that film and its legacy. Starting with you, Keith, what do you think about Back to the Future?
Putting me on the spot. Well, back to the future. Well, I can say from my own perspective that it was part three that really worked its way into my psyche. So when we get to the summer of 1990, I'll probably have more to say, because that was the summer I got my braces on, and the same day I got my braces on was the day I saw Back to the Future 3, because I wanted to see how the story concluded. The original Back to the Future, however, you know, I think was, as with a lot of the stuff in 1985, you know, and looking through the list that Aaron sent to me when we were, you know, collating all the titles and everything, and I was trying to get writers to cover a lot of them, I think a lot of them were, like with Summer of 83 and Summer of 84, caught up on video for me. And I know that Back to the Future was one of those things, one of those movies that really made a deep impression on video. And then, of course, when the sequels came out, you know, it was like part two and part three were, like, you know, really, really big for me. I can't tell you exactly when I first saw the original Back to the Future. And it's so funny because I think parts two and three kind of have wended their way more into my mind, to the point that when I did revisit the trilogy in full, you know, I had forgotten that you know, the whole Libyan thread from the first one,
right,
which
right.
kind of mysteriously vanishes over the other two sequels,
along with Huey Lewis.
Exactly. So I mean, it's funny, and of course, it's funny then is that, you know, the sequels still take place in 1985, or 1985 is the place to get back to, but they kind of look back at 85 from 89, 90 even, you know, in a weird way, where, you know, they're sort of like out of time movies in a strange way, the two follow-ups, since they were made 4 and 5 years later, were shot back-to-back, as I recall, anyway. But, yeah, I mean, Back to the Future, I mean, I think it, you know, I don't know if that was the kind of thing where it was, you know, conceived maybe with the other two in mind, and or if it was just like the to be continued was just sort of a facetious thing in the sense of, you know, this could go on forever. You know, we could just travel around, you know, forever. There might be some history here that I'm not really aware of.
That's an interesting question. I guarantee if it was not a hit, there wouldn't have been a two or three.
Yeah, that's very true. And of course, it still took 4 years to make, I guess, because Zemeckis, like, jumped right into Roger Rabbit, which I know they shot, I think, in, like, the live-action stuff in 86, and it just took, like, 2 years for the animation to get completed. So,
yeah,
obviously, he had that on his plate. But, yeah, I mean, of course, if Back to the Future wasn't a hit, then we'd be left with that to be continued. Sort of like, I wonder, like, if Star Wars wasn't a hit, it would be kind of like, you know, would there be anything, you know, further to that? Albeit that
no.
To be continued. So,
right.
You know, and there wouldn't be the father thing and all that. So I mean, it's kind of like, you know, seems to me like Back to the Future is one of those Star Wars films of the 80s, I suppose.
It is.
Really, I mean, even to the point, like, I was watching a Doctor Who episode recently, and in order to explain time travel, one of the new Doctor Whos, he just basically said, Back to the Future, if Marty McFly doesn't save things, then he gets erased from history, and that was how he could best explain time travel.
Right.
That's very clever on their part.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of worked, it's kind of become the de facto time travel text, I suppose, for popular culture and for the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
At least as far as the state of the United States is concerned. So
it's certainly not primer.
And even England, based on Doctor Who. So.
Yeah, the granddaddy of time travel is using Back to the Future.
Exactly. I mean, I mean, as far as for me, it's funny. You know, it's kind of like the movie I just sort of observe it kind of from a distance for me. I mean, I like it quite a bit, but, you know, I like 2 and 3. 2 and 3 hit me a bit more, probably because, you know, they were the ones that I did catch in the theater, and had more of a memory of, and they were more primal in that sense. Whereas the first one was just kind of like, oh, everybody's talking about it, therefore I caught up with it kind of after the fact. So yeah,
I understand that sensation. Once a movie kind of becomes a phenomenon, it's harder for it to be a personal kind of experience for you. I've had movies that did that to me before.
Oh yeah,
some that I felt that I discovered, and then everyone else in the world is talking about it, and it feels a little less like mine.
No, we've talked about that at great length, actually, on this show.
Yeah. Aaron, it's ironic. It's a movie about time travel, and yet I think it's still so timeless because, like I said before, it's so immaculately crafted. So energetic, and the performances are so infectious and enjoyable. Do you find that it has aged at all since 85?
Well, it's the weird thing is that Back to the Future is one of those films, because it's about time travel, it's kind of, it automatically sort of becomes a time capsule piece of the story that it's telling and then of when it came out. So, As opposed to like Demolition Man is a time capsule film of the early 90s Stallone action film.
Yeah.
You know, I think Back to the Future is a time capsule of that very mid 80s boomer Reagan era type feel to it. And it's interesting. It is interesting that, you know, it was a Steven Spielberg production. Robert Zemeckis directed it. But if you go back and look at the reviews, a lot of the critics, most critics liked the film. A few of the naysayers at the time, or the ones that were kind of a little apprehensive about overpraising it, that film kind of represents this period in Spielberg's career where critics were really going to hold back and put his feet to the fire on stuff. It had started with Temple of Doom a year earlier, which a lot of people called as heartless, and then with Back to the Future, I know some critics who claim, because I think Spielberg had a quote at the time saying, you know, this is the ultimate Leave It to Beaver episode, and you know that was his kind of pitch. And a lot of
I wish he'd just shut up sometimes. you know his
wait,
movie,
he actually said that.
I think you know, this was during the ad, you know, during the run up to the publicity of the film. So you know, this is all filmmakers. When filmmakers are doing a run up to their big summer tentpole film, you almost have to just kind of pare it down to a bare essential, you know, to get it across. And it's what the reporters take. And so, and Spielberg and Lucas are kind of masters at the selling. And it doesn't take away from their art.
No, but I mean,
I'd hate how he pitched to hear how he pitched Amistad.
Yeah, really. I mean, I'm not going to say it because it's so wrong on every level. But
there's sub movies that are a little too weighty to classify in three words.
It's Perry Mason set during the slave era.
Oh.
Keith, what were you saying about Spielberg and his propensity to do that sort of thing?
You know, when he talks, he puts his foot in his mouth so much. And when he gets behind a camera, there's, like, practically no one better. You know, I don't mean to devalue any filmmakers through that, but I'm just saying, as far as, like, innate talent, ability to tell, you know, the American narrative story, or the American, the way that, you know, the standard Hollywood cinema story is usually done in, like, shorthand and just in momentum and in meaning, I would even say. You know, because, I mean, The Color Purple was on the horizon for him in 85, too, and I think that's a wonderful, very misunderstood film.
Mm-hmm.
And a very progressive film, not just because of the skin color of its people, but I think also as far as being a gay film. But I guess that's an entirely other discussion. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, when he gets behind a camera, he's so brilliant to me. And, you know, it took me a while to really see that. This is not to say that he's infallible, but when you put him down in front of a camera to talk, my God, he just says the stupidest things sometimes. And I mean, just to hear him say, it's the ultimate Leave It to Beaver episode. I mean, you know, he's trying to be ingratiating to you know, a large cross section of people. But I mean,
this is where the
naysayers have a point, where they say that, you know, his films dumb down the public. I don't think it's his films that dumb down the public, because I think his films are brilliant. I think it's his publicity that dumbs down, you know, the public and the conversation, and ultimately leads to a lot of these, you know, cheap imitators. You know, his style is so easily imitated because I think, you know, he talks about it so much. You know, I think, honestly, Tarantino does it too.
Oh, yeah, I was going to bring him up.
I have problems with the way Tarantino talks about things, you know, because I think he's too out, he speaks too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I almost wish these guys would take the Malick way of, you know, of not saying anything. You know,
disappearing.
Just disappearing. Albeit, you know, I mean, how much does it affect the art? Well, sometimes I think this the way they talk, you know, and the publicity makes its way known in the worst of their art. But
yeah.
I think if you really... go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I want to add a name to that. Someone who I think is a brilliant filmmaker, I think is his own worst enemy, is Oliver Stone, when he speaks.
Yeah.
I mean...
whose documentary I just saw yesterday.
South of the Border?
South of the Border.
Oh,
yeah.
You've seen it. Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, similarly, but there, you know, what's really funny is I think the Stone persona is so interesting and so integral to this documentary, which is extremely flawed. But I mean, what I admire about it there is that he, in the documentary, he really puts himself front and center and basically says, you know, this is what I believe, and I admire that. He basically hawks a loogie in America's face, and you know, in American propriety's face, and everything of what even I would say leftists, rightists, whatever you want, would really want to do. I mean, here he is essentially hanging out with Hugo Chavez as he's riding a kid's bicycle, or playing with the, I think it's the Uruguayan president, playing soccer with him. It's like, you know, he just goes down there, he's kicking a ball around, and it's like, you're fucking nuts. I mean, and I'm glad you're fucking nuts, but, you know, so in a way, I would almost defend Stone a bit more, because I think Stone has the courage of his convictions.
We talk about Stone a lot on the show, and the Oliver Stone that we know and love is the batshit Oliver Stone, and we never want that to go away.
Yeah.
Right, and he's not. I don't think he's really trying to package it in the same way that like Spielberg and Lucas and Tarantino are. I think there's a pander to the masses. Thing in the way they talk about their movies, whereas Stone, I don't think, at his best, I don't think he gives two shits what people think. Because he's just going to go out there and be himself, you know. And so I admire that a bit more. I admire someone a bit more, even when I wouldn't agree with them, than I do with like Spielberg or whatever, just coming out and saying it's the ultimate Leave It to Beaver. Fuck you.
Better than that. we've got a lot of movies to cover from this summer. We're going to go in order of release date, and Jerry, we're going to start with you for the first movie.
God. How can I follow those two guys? Never mind. I'm not going to make the analogy.
Just the first thought that comes to your mind, but leading up to this first movie, May 3rd, we're starting out with, we had releases Movers and Shakers, Pumping Iron 2, The Women, Private Resort, Gotcha,
oh, God.
Gymkhana,
I think Keith would agree that that's a lot of gay movies on one day.
And we're not done. This is the movie that I want to ask Jerry about to start off this conversation. Here's a brief clip of what we're talking about. Also released on May 3rd.
In Code of Silence, Norris plays a Chicago cop, an honest cop, who gets messed up with a mafia, drug dealers, gang warfare, and a mobster's kidnapped daughter who is innocent and who he's trying to protect. Chuck Norris has some of the same appeal there, I think, as Clint Eastwood, who was kind of a taciturn sort of exterior and a feeling of great strength. Code of Silence is remarkable mainly because it does exactly what a thriller is supposed to do, and these days, that's remarkable. It gives us interesting characters, it tells a good story, it has great stunts and great action sequences, and I think that's what we want when we go to see a thriller. Chuck Norris is good in this movie because he doesn't grandstand. He plays a tough cop who doesn't make speeches. This movie's like a machine to show us how a good thriller can work, and it works so convincingly that by the end, when Norris has called in an automated armored tank as his secret weapon, and these movies always seem to end with the hero bringing in some previously undisclosed weapon or gun of some sort, well, we know that this tank doesn't exist in the real world, but somehow that doesn't even feel like a gimmick in the movie because Norris has made his own character so believable. I like this movie. I was surprised by it.
Yeah, I was surprised by it too, because frequently in Chuck Norris's pictures, the good and the better than the good, the bad, and the lousy, what's happened is the action stops so we can show off his kung fu kickboxing because he thinks that's his main strength. Well, I think he should realize now after this picture, and I guess he has realized, he doesn't need to rely on that anymore. He can be a good, serviceable action hero, reminding me more, frankly, of Steve McQueen because of his stature than Eastwood.
Okay, I chose to go with the Siskel and Ebert clip talking about Code of Silence because all the movie clips I could find were just sound effects of fists hitting faces.
This is the high point, I guess, in Chuck's. I mean, long before he became Sarah Palin's best friend, this is the high point. And I say that only in hindsight, really, because of Andrew Davis's direction, you know, later with The Package and The Fugitive and those kind of films. But, this is the high point. I think I saw this on videotape, but I remember at the time I was like, yeah, this is better than Invasion USA, which I thought was laughably just like one of the I just remember reading that on we were reading that on VHS for watching it. You guys, someone put money up for this? Oh, my God. But
well,
no,
if you remember, earlier that year, I think he had Missing in Action 2 that came out.
Mm-hmm. That wasn't bad. From what I remember, watching that late one night on VHS. That was actually, I actually kind of preferred that too.
It's like the poor man's Rambo, right?
Dude, it's like no, it's like
wow.
No, it's like the fuck, you know, the home. Never mind. But
so, Code of Silence. What you expressed it, and it's expressed there in the Siskel and Ebert review. I haven't seen it since in years.
Decades. I mean, decades.
I'm sad to say I haven't watched every movie from this summer again to prepare for the show. But
I only watched one, actually.
Vivid recollection was that I was shocked that a Chuck Norris movie got raves.
Mm-hmm.
And by raves, I mean good reviews, which is a rave for a Chuck Norris film, generally.
Yeah.
But everyone said he's strong, he's tough. He doesn't speak any more than he has to, and it's good, competent action. And I think you're right; it can be attributed to Andrew Davis and what
we saw
from him, you know, later on in his career with The Fugitive and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay, that was an exciting pick.
Yeah.
I just want to give a shout out that Siskel and Ebert dared to fully embrace a Chuck Norris film. Where a lot of the other critics at the time, they would kind of, even those that gave it a good review, they were kind of condescending to it, but not Siskel and Ebert. They said, no, this is good entertainment. So
yeah.
That's a model for any critic to follow.
Aaron?
I have to catch up. Yeah.
You have the next pick.
Okay.
And I don't have a clip for every pick that we're discussing tonight.
That's fine.
But as soon as I bring up my clip, okay, here it is. Okay. I brought up my switchboard. Here is your pick to discuss after we listen to this clip.
Okay.
You're just a prostitute. Someone who sells her body to anyone with a financial wherewithal to...
All right. That'll be enough of that kind of talk.
What the hell are you?
Just a stranger passing through.
Where in the hell do you get that shirt?
How a person dresses is nobody's business but his or her own.
What?
You heard me. This is just a warning. If you or your men draw on me, I'll shoot each man in the hand.
In the hand?
That's right.
Not in the face or the chest?
Nope.
I don't like the idea of getting shot in the hand.
All right, that was released May 10th. It is the Western kind of parody, Rustler's Rhapsody, starring Tom Berenger and Mary Lou Henner.
Mary Lou Henner was in that?
Yes. It was the summer of Taxi at the movies. Christopher Lloyd in Back to the Future and Mary Lou Henner. I'm sure Judd Hirsch did something that year. So, Aaron, what'd you think of Rustler's Rhapsody? What do you think when I say that title?
Wow, I think that says it all right there.
The only interesting thing about Rustler's Rhapsody is that the summer of '85 got a lot of hype as this kind of revival of the Western kind of summer, because you had that with a parody. Everyone was waiting for Silverado. Clint Eastwood had one of his early revisionist Westerns in
mm-hmm.
The Pale Rider,
yeah.
Where, you know, no dialogue was needed or wanted. Even Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, which is the third in the series, had a very, probably the most Western feel to it. So that's the thing is Rustler's Rhapsody. I think it was, what is that, 85? So what is that? It's like 12 years, 11 years after Blazing Saddles. And so it just, you know, you really, if you're going to, you know, there's nothing more you could parody after something like Blazing Saddles. And
mm-hmm.
Berenger's a good actor, but he's never – I think that might be his only comedy, and I think he learned early on.
What about Betrayed?
Oh, Betrayed.
I'm joking. I'm sorry. That was horrible. I hope I go to hell for that.
Or what about Last Rites? Last Rites is hilarious.
Oh, my God. He's in Inception. I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, he is. He is? Yeah.
He plays a character called Browning. But
does he play like Joseph Gordon-Levitt's dad or something?
That would be something. Wow.
Yeah, his greatest comedy is Platoon. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, come on. Speaking of Stone.
So, yeah, all right. Rustler's Rhapsody.
He was in Major League, but but anyway.
Oh, that's
right.
No, that's
you're
Major
right.
League was good. I like Major. Okay, I'm going to shut up for the rest.
So, you know, roughly Rap City, not very, you know, not good.
From the director
okay.
of Police Academy.
No, I actually have something to say about Rustler's Rhapsody, but...
Okay, go ahead, Jerry.
I'm sorry. I have to preface everything for the rest of the night. I'm sorry. Before I have a friend and a guy I used to work for. I did, like, some video production work. That's his all-time favorite film.
Mm. There's one.
Wow. Okay, so I just wanted to throw that out there. I'm sure that I'll get hate mail tomorrow, but, yeah. That's
we should have brought him on as a guest to talk about Rustler's Rhapsody and what he looked.
Now, can all of you tell me what director Hugh Wilson did next?
Was it Revolution? No, Revolution was Revolution
Hugh
was 85, wasn't it?
No,
that's Hugh Hudson.
Hugh Wilson, who directed Police Academy and then did Rustler's Rhapsody, he did not direct Revolution. That would be something.
I would see Hugh Wilson directing Al Pacino in Revolution. That might have been.
And ironically, Revolution was his funniest film.
What was his next feature?
I don't know.
Do you know? Tell me, please.
Oh, I know.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Burglar.
Oh.
Hey, I need another drink. Okay.
I will defend Burglar, but not right now.
Well, we get to the summer of 87, Aaron.
Not the movie, but an actual burglar.
87, you're on, dude. You got a whole show to yourself. You're welcome to come on and do it.
Anyway.
I think that's hysterical. I would defend Burglar. Not the movie, but an actual burglar. May 10th also saw the release of Rappin'. Okay.
Rappin'. Oh, boy.
That's Keith's favorite film.
Yeah. May 22nd, we have two films to talk about that were in release. Keith,
yeah.
I'll give you this one. Here's a quick clip.
Johnny, this is Troughton. Where the hell are you? John, come in.
Murda.
He's here.
Rambo, this is Murdoch. We're glad you're alive.
Where are you? Give us your position and we'll come to pick you up.
Murdoch. I'm coming to get you.
Wow.
Rambo, First Blood Part 2. It is all you, Keith. Go ahead.
Do we get to win this time?
That's the scene I would have played. That's the scene I would have played. I mean, okay.
Murdoch, I'm going to get you. Good God. Yeah. No, I mean, as you maybe you remember, I wrote this long piece on the Rambo series for UGO about a year and a half, 2 years ago, when they released the box set of the four Rambo movies. I think Rambo First Blood Part 2, having revisited it relatively recently in that time frame, is probably the worst Rambo movie out there. in a kind of spectacular way. I mean, you know, the first Rambo is a really, really great movie until it gets really confused at the end. I mean, really how the first Rambo should have ended is with the original ending, which is that Rambo shoots himself. You know, and dies, but then of course you couldn't have all these crazy sequels where basically he wins the Vietnam War in part two. He joins up with the Mujahideen in part three. Whoops, didn't see that one coming, I guess. And then in the fourth Rambo, which I think is an absolutely astonishing movie in so many ways, and I adore it.
I want to go to the Expendables with Keith.
I think that's like one of the greatest works of right-wing art that I've ever seen. I mean, just
yes.
unapologetically
You're right, yeah.
Unapologetically right-wing art and and brilliant because Stallone wrote and directed it, and it just so represents his psyche and his persona perfectly in so many ways. I mean, that movie impressed the hell out of me. I think when people described Apocalypto as Werner Herzog's Rambo 4, that was before Rambo 4 came out and actually won up to it. So, I mean, that's something for another time. I think, you know, Rambo First Blood Part 2 just basically takes the worst aspect of First Blood, which is the ending, and makes an entire movie out of it. You know,
right.
It's just like, Rambo is unstoppable Superman. It's completely cartoonish. I mean, and I don't think even, you know, particularly good. Just watching it, it's kind of like it's directed by ultra hack George Pan Cosmatos. George P. Cosmatos. Yeah, no, I he's a terrible director. I mean, I in my opinion, Aaron, I think wants to jump in on there.
Wait, he's probably drinking scotch with John Huston right now on whatever film
you,
director.
You didn't like Ella. Leviathan?
I mean, what was the other Tombstone, I think, is a dud.
Cobra, the all-time great bad movie of the 80s.
What's the train movie he did with all the stars on the train, the Cassandra Crossing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
He did that?
Yes, just really atrocity after atrocity in my opinion.
But what was the liquor bill like on the Cassandra Crossing? That's what I've always wanted to know.
I don't know, but I mean, you know, just in watching all the Rambos back to back, I mean, that's just the one where it's kind of like the politics are so reprehensible, as I think they are in all the other Rambos, you know, at least in the sequel. But, you know, Stallone does it in the fourth one with this incredible artistry that I think is lacking in the second one. The second one is just reprehensibly bad to me.
Yeah.
The politics are just so glaringly awful, and I even just think it's kind of like cursory. I don't think anybody believes what they're selling. And then and the third one is just kind of like a boring muddle, frankly.
Right.
I agree with you there.
Yeah. I will say this. I love the Rambo 2 Nintendo video game. So that's kind of like my affectionate thing for Rambo
as a movie, yeah. It's a great video game.
As a movie, it's a great video game. I really have no affection for it. It's I think that basically Stallone took the sequels to their ultra in this last Rambo. Which did bring everything full circle and kind of justified the stupid ending of, you know, First Blood as much as you could.
Right.
First Blood Part 2 is notable, obviously, because it financially it was the most successful of the four films. And, it's a surprising screenplay coming out of him, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess you could say that maybe he brought the Terminator aspects of Rambo. You know, maybe this is why it's a confused film, because I don't know. I don't really think of, you know, I mean, I guess people look at Avatar politically, but I just don't really think of Cameron as a political filmmaker, frankly. I just think he's good at the mechanics of things, at the basic mechanics of storytelling. And so from that angle, First Blood Part 2 is very good, I suppose, because it's basically like Rambo gets out of jail, he goes to Vietnam, he wins the war, he comes back, he kicks Murdoch's ass. You know, it's like there's a rhythm to it that's very lacking in Part 3. You know, especially Part 3 just kind of lays there and nothing happens. Whereas I will say in defense of Part 2, Part 2 at least moves. It moves stupidly, like a big lumbering beast, I suppose. But it moves like a story should, I suppose.
And he gives, you got to admit, Stallone in that one film gives Mel Gibson a run for his money when it comes to having the character be inflicted with pain.
That's true.
Inflicted with pain, and then ultimately delivering that speech at the end. Good God, I mean.
Yeah, well, no.
Inflicting us with pain at the end.
It was the original. It was the precursor to Braveheart.
No, kind of. But Keith is bringing up a very important point, because there's an interview in the New York Times Magazine section, like when Rambo 3 came out, and a lot of people had a lot of trouble with the fact that, you know, Stallone, you know, when it was his time to serve in Vietnam, was teaching at a Swiss or Swedish boarding school.
Right.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of controversy around this. You know, how, you know, a lot of people, some vets are like, how dare he go back and, like, refight the Vietnam War when he was, you know.
Yeah.
So I think Keith is actually bringing up a lot of valid points here.
I should also mention, and this is an interesting thing, and I think points out why the film is such bullshit politically. You know, first of all, of course, Reagan latched onto it. So it's really a quintessential film of the Reagan era. And, you know,
it's
Reagan,
the film, I think, of the Reagan era.
It's probably the film. In that way, it's very important in that sense. But, and I heard this from my friend and fellow colleague, Godfrey Cheshire, who studies Iranian cinema and is very familiar with, like, Middle Eastern culture and everything. And he's talked about how pictures of Rambo from Rambo First Blood Part II adorn a lot of Middle Eastern children's walls because they don't see him as a symbol of American, you know, machismo. They just see him as a symbol of, like, purity and male triumphalism, in a sense, that's not specifically American. And so that way, this, and from that movie specifically, you know, and this is the movie where Rambo is most perfectly male, I would say, you know, in terms of, like, his physique, in terms of his youth.
And hetero, because they give him a Vietnamese girlfriend for at least 5 minutes.
Yes, hetero, I guess maybe you could apply that too, but it's interesting that particular image of Rambo crosses cultures. I mean, what I think is great about, you know, the fourth Rambo is that, you know, he's weathered and old, and, you know, his muscles, you know, it's obvious he has to work hard to maintain all that, you know, and so he becomes a bit more human. Here, this one is where he is most godlike, you know, which is part of the reason that I suppose he moves across different cultures and stuff. So, I mean, it's an interesting thing, but I think that points out why the film ideologically is so stupid. It doesn't have an ideological stance, really, because it can just be latched onto by anyone. You know,
well,
so it's a Dada kind of, you know, thing that just, like, anybody can read anything into it.
I do remember parodies of that image, the main image of Stallone from part two.
Yeah.
You know, scar chested and muscles popping out all over the place, holding a huge rocket launcher.
Remember the Reagan?
And the Reagan parody where they called him Ronbo. Yeah, with Reagan's head on the body. Yeah.
And wasn't Hot Shots Part Two where they did the whole Rambo?
They did a great job, I thought, on that. I was the only person who liked that movie in my circle, but yeah.
And also, Hot Shots Part Two came a little late in that. Let's not forget the immortal UHF.
That's right.
You're absolutely right.
Let's not forget
the
that.
Immortal.
Yeah, the immortal. It'll never die.
Summer of 89 can't come quickly enough. I know.
Okay, we're going to keep going on the round table. I expanded the show just in case because we're running a little bit late.
You really want to make a fool out of me. Okay, this is awesome.
This is also May 22nd, Jerry. This belongs to you. Here's a clip.
Brewster, greetings from the grave. Don't look so surprised. Didn't you know your great-grandfather was a honky? Oh, man, I married twice. One wife, white. Produce me. One wife, black. Produce your grandmother. Checkered family, you might say. I've outlived them all, except you. They tell me you're my only living relative, Brewster, and I gotta say I'm very disappointed. Look at you. What have you made of yourself? A failed baseball player. I believe in being honest, Brewster. No bullshit. I'm stuck with you. But we're gonna have some fun. Let me tell you a little story, Brewster. When I was 7 years old, my daddy caught me smoking a cigar. Locked me in the broom closet for 3 days and three nights with nothing but a box of cigars and a book of matches. No food, Brewster. No water, just those goddamn cigars. Wouldn't let me out till I finished every last one of them. Taught me one hell of a lesson. I'm going to do to you what my daddy did to me. I'm going to teach you to hate spending money. I'm going to make you so sick of spending money that the mere sight of it will make you want to throw up. So, here's my proposition.
You have 30 days in which to spend $30 million. If you can do it, you get $300 million.
There's got to be a catch.
Of course there's a catch. You have to spend the $30 million. But after 30 days, you're not allowed to own any assets. No houses, no cars, no jewelry. Nothing but the shirt on your back. So it sounds easy, don't it? Well, you'll find out.
Okay. That's Brewster's Millions, directed by Walter Hill.
Yeah, that's one of the two John Candy movies that summer, that and Summer Rental.
Summer Rental, yeah.
Both
yeah.
disappointments, but I didn't see Brewster's Millions until it came on videotape, and I haven't. This is something I loved about the early days of VHS. I would always, like on the weekends, watch movies with my older brother Michael, who was in graduate school at the time, and we watched a lot of great movies. This was not one of them. I just remember being, this isn't very good, and it has all these great, talented people in it, and it's just not good. I don't remember much about it, to be honest with you. And that whatever you just played, I don't remember when that took place, but I just remember, wow, maybe people in the should have been paying attention to this, not spending, you know, maybe saving money instead of spending it all at once.
Well, I actually rewatched it a couple of months ago. It was on cable.
Is it good? I mean, I don't remember that much about it. So
it's a fluff. I mean, it passes the time.
Yeah, I mean, I just remember at the time because I liked, you know, Richard Pryor and John Candy.
Yeah.
And this was like really when this must have been like, I guess, either late 85 or early 86 when I watched it on videotape. That's probably an alien concept to most of our audience, videotape. But, yeah, I just remember being disappointed.
It's not really a movie worthy of that pairing. I mean, you would hope for more juicy interaction between
yeah.
the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it came right after the year after Streets of Fire, which is a very, very, very interesting Walter Hill movie. And,
that was ahead of its time, I thought.
A underrated Walter Hill movie.
Very underrated. Yeah.
You know, Brewster's Millions. Yeah, it kind of buckles under the weight, I guess, of being a prior vehicle, and you know, and other things. I mean, I think there are some. Hill has good can do like crowd scenes and also musical numbers really well. I think he's an unsung musical number. Filmer, you know, and I seem to recall there might even be something like some kind of interlude like that in Brewster's Millions. I mean, I'm not really sure.
Yeah, there's lots of buses full of people and big crowd scenes in Brewster's Millions. Yeah,
you know, I'm remembering like that clip you played was, I know, Hume Cronin basically laying out what Brewster had to do at the beginning. But I mean, I remember actually the opening credits, like a whole baseball game that Brewster's playing. And there's really an interesting sense of life in that scene that's kind of missing from the rest of the film once the plot kind of weighs in on everything.
Right,
right. No.
You know, Hill has such talent, and that's really not representative of his best, though.
Well, and it's been a while since he's directed anything, and he was the first person to turn us down for an interview when I was putting together the series, and they said he's busy working on a project. I was like, well, how long has he been working on this project? And then it was announced he has an upcoming film with Pierce Brosnan that he's doing.
Yes, and looking at it right now, it's St. Vincent, it's called. Production begins on July 12th this year, apparently, and Pierce Brosnan plays a hitman who goes undercover to get to his target. And it looks like Maria Bello, Giovanni Ribisi, and Billy Bob Thornton are also in it. So
that's quite a cast. So.
I'd be interested to see where he goes with this.
The best Hill, or for the most part, the Streets of Fire is cheeky, but Hill is an R-rated filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
That's just there's no way about it. So Richard Pryor and John Candy, those two comic geniuses in a Walter Hill film, that should be a hard R, you know, foul mouth comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And not a kid's film, not a family-friendly film. And the one thing I've
always
bugged, there's yet to be a good film, because they have this premise of either having a power or money, and you get to have free reign. And it's never been fulfilled. I've never seen a film where that concept has been reflected on something that I would do. I remember, you know, it's kind of, when hearing that clip, I was thinking of the movie Jumper, Mm-hmm. And I remember the movie, I hated Jumper so much because here was this high school kid who could be anywhere in the world and do anything. And he, not only did he seem such a drip, but he never did the things that I would have done at 16.
Right.
Same thing with Bruce Deuce Million. If you give me 30 million in 30 days, you know, at, you know, the whole point is you're going to get sick of spending money. Well, at least that initial couple of million, you want to have some fun.
Right.
And there's never any fun that Richard Pryor seems to have about spending money. You know, he could go down and, you know, have a scene where he goes and buys, you know, the best high-priced, you know, hookers. You know,
right, right, right. Now, I understand. Aaron brings up an awesome point. There are these films, and I know, you know, and we don't, I mean, I know it's very individual what we're, what you're saying, what we would do in that situation, but these films do fizzle for the most part,
yeah.
And that's a very good point that Aaron brings up.
Well, plus you know exactly where they're going. I mean, you know he's going to find out what he truly values in life, and it's not $30 million by the end of the film. And
a movie with Gene Wilder?
It would be great if, it being Richard Pryor, if he didn't find that out at the end of the movie. That would be unexpected. That would be great. Okay.
Yeah.
Aaron,
anyway.
A View to a Kill released May 24th.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
Grace Jones. Sorry.
Well, I remember Roger Moore made the comment on the set that he knew that was going to be his last film when he realized that he was older than Maude Adams' mother.
Oh God!
And so he's like, this is gonna be my last James Bond film. Looking at it now, you kind of cringe at the fact that, you know, you had Christopher Walken as a Bond villain, and he's one of the least memorable Bond villains, except for his blonde hair.
I know. Yeah.
You have Grace Jones, one of the great physical specimens of female specimens of that era, and she has a couple of cool scene where she shows off her body, but you know, once again, this is the early mid '80s, and so you know, they did not know how to use powerful, sexy black women in films. They all, you know, if it wasn't Cicely Tyson, then they didn't know what to do with it. With the black women, and so yeah, so it's all these missed opportunities.
No,
Tanya
right.
Roberts just screams, but. The one good thing in the film, and I do defend this as a pop connoisseur, I do think it does have one of the better theme songs.
He's right.
Right.
He's absolutely
yes, you're right.
Right.
You're right.
And actually, I will say this. The video for the Duran Duran theme song is a better, more exciting, compact Bond film than the All of A View to a Kill.
He's
well,
got
you
an
know.
Awesome point there. I mean...
You know, the and Grace Jones, I remember, they didn't sell it on Christopher Walken. They sold it on Grace Jones. And I remember the poster of them standing, she and Roger Moore standing back to back, and the tagline being, has James Bond finally met his match? They're trying to sell it on the exotica of...
That was the second... The first tagline was, James Bond has jungle fever. That didn't go
wow.
over.
No,
wow.
it didn't. Really? It didn't say that.
It did.
All right. Moving on.
James Bond goes dark.
Oh, man. Oh, Mr. Ed, you shouldn't say that.
May 31st saw the release of a film called Sylvia and another film, which is one of the more popular films that has survived from that summer, that we actually covered last week with Dana Wheeler Nicholson. And Keith, what are your thoughts on Fletch?
Fletch, wow. Again, a catch-up on video kind of movie. I remember this being a film that my mom and dad really loved, and they were like, we got to watch Fletch, you know? And I think as I recall, it's kind of like, it's Chevy Chase doing comedy, but showing a bit more, being a bit more serious about it than in some of his other movies. If I'm not mistaken, I mean, I haven't seen it in so long, you know, but, and I see as I'm looking at it here on IMDb, it's directed by Michael Ritchie, screenplay was by Andrew Bergman, so, I mean, you know, talented guys of a moment, I would say, you know, I mean, they've done some shit, let's put it that way, but, you know, they do have a rep that, you know, that an interesting rep, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, but yeah, it's like, and now it just seems like Fletch is one of those movies that has always been, you know, talked about in terms of being a remake, you know, or mm-hmm. being remade. I think, didn't Kevin Smith have something in the pipeline?
He did, right. That's long gone.
Yeah, and I mean, I even think, though, that there might have been other people talking about
They wanted to make it like the books, you know, because the books were much more serious than the film.
Right. No, and I mean, it's kind of like, I guess maybe, I don't know if it's one of those films now, if I were to look at it now, that's kind of like Chevy Chase sort of trying to be a bit more serious and yet still holding on to that comic persona, like Memoirs of an Invisible Man or something like that, you know, where it doesn't quite work. I mean, I'm not really sure. You guys would probably know better.
I think Fletch still works. I watched it recently, actually, and when you say Chevy Chase being serious, I think... Not necessarily being serious, but taking it seriously. I think he's invested in a way in this. Invested in a way in this project because he knows it's a good project, or better quality than he was used to being a part of, and he shines in it. I mean, he's able to try on all these different personas, and it's a great character for him. I think his shining moment in terms of a character in his career. I mean, you have the Vacation movies, which kind of became parodies of themselves after they went on, but Fletch is kind of a singular moment in his career, I think.
Right.
Which takes us to June. It only took us an hour to get through May.
Wow.
June 7th saw the release of a film called The Holy Innocents, and a great undiscovered gem starring John Travolta and Jamie Lee Curtis called Perfect. Yeah, and with Perfect, you know, that was around the time that gyms were becoming all the rage.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they tried to appeal to men and women by doing like an investigative story about corruption at
the
gym.
The high point of Jan Winter's career in the 80s.
Yes.
Wow. Jan Winter is just magnificent. He is so
cheerfully
smug and perfect. I assume it's acting. I don't want to cast aspersions that Jan Winter is playing himself, but I do not know.
But also, the big movie on June 7th, and Jerry, this is what I want to ask you about, is outside of Back to the Future, I think the movie that has survived like no other movie from that summer, and that is The Goonies.
I was hoping you would ask me about the ML Forest, but I guess I'm not going to get that lucky.
Well, that doesn't come out until July.
I know, I realize that, but I walked home from the movie theater and saw it twice in the movie theater. Okay, never mind. But, no, The Goonies, I remember, God, I went to the movies a lot with Steve Richards that summer. Good guy. And I liked it. I mean, I enjoyed it, but I have to be honest, I don't have the affinity that a lot of my contemporaries have for it, but I enjoyed it. I remember the first thing is it has a lot of Spielberg regulars in it. The Short Round, and if I'm not mistaken, the older brother from E.T. is in it.
Yeah.
No, that's Josh Brolin.
The older brother from E.T. is not in it. Yeah, Josh Brolin is the one who...
Josh Brolin. This was his defining film until Milk.
Yeah.
Until Milk? Really? You want to go to Milk? Okay, that's cool. No, but I mean, I like The Goonies. There's a lot of little things I remember about the movie, not big things. I don't remember the big set pieces, but there's just a lot of little interesting shots that have always stayed with me. But it was the first of those movies. You have The Goonies, you have The Explorers, and then all these movies. But the Goonies, I like, but I don't. It's not like an all-time favorite, though.
You know, I think that it's one of those movies that I don't have the affinity for it that a lot of other people do either, but I think it's one of those that takes them back, that reminds them of the innocence of childhood and when they used to watch that movie 1,000 times when they were a certain age as a little kid. And you know, it's a cult hit. They just reunited the cast and some of the film crew where they shot it, and I forgot where they shot it, but they have this event every year, every 5 years, where they reunite and all the fans show up. I mean, it has survived.
I'm really scared to tell you the movie that I have the affinity for. And it's not that year. My God, the movie I have the affinity for is Penelope Spheeris' Suburbia.
Oh.
That's the movie, that and River's Edge, Tim Hunter's River's Edge. Those are the two movies that I go back and oh, God,
that,
I mean, maybe you should...
That reminds you of being a kid, of the innocence
yeah,
of being
those
a kid?
No, those are the films that I just keep going back to, though. I went back to in college and after. Do you want to cut my phone line off now, or do you want me to stay on?
No, I think Goonies is a different kind of nostalgia.
Yeah, I do like Goonies, don't get me wrong. But and Corey Feldman's in it, so I can't, you know. And Martha Plimpton, who, oh, yeah, I mean.
Okay.
And Short Round. But anyway.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I know, I can't
and I tried to get him. I really want to talk to him, but
yeah.
Anyway.
No time for love, Dr. Jones.
No time for interview. Okay.
Oh, no.
Okay, Keith, I actually want to give you the next one, and then I'll go to Aaron for the one after this. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this film. June 14th is when this film came out. It opened up against Daryl and Secret Admirer. And this stood out not only that weekend, but in the entire summer. Here's a clip.
For Charlie Partena and Irene Walker, it was love at first sight. They discovered they had the same taste in clothing.
Who liked this so bad? Who stand out? In New York, you know.
The same fiery passion.
Kiss me,
Charlie.
And then they discovered they had the same line of work.
I've been doing 3-4 hits a year for the last few years, most of them full pay.
That many?
Well, it's not many if you consider the size of the population.
But in the Pootsie family...
I'm gonna move Dominic out to Vegas and make you boss.
It's always dangerous.
You the contractor?
Who is it?
Brooklyn fella, Charlie Partena.
To mix pleasure with business.
I go looking for the bad guy and it turns out to be my woman. Can you imagine this?
All right, John Huston's Pritzy's Honor.
Right.
Wow. You know, we've been talking about all these really kind of dumb movies this summer, and there are a couple that just stick out like a sore thumb, and this is the first one, Pritzy's Honor. What are your thoughts on it, Keith?
Well, this is where I guess I have to admit my blind spot, that I've never seen Pritzy's Honor.
What?
It's one of those things, but I think I can talk about this from this perspective because it does bring up something that I kind of want to get into, which is late John Huston movies, which I have been watching some of, you know, like Wise Blood and.
Oh, that's a good movie.
I'm forgetting some of the others. I'm going to.
Under
well,
the Volcano.
Pritzy's Honor was the next to the last film he made.
Mm-hmm.
He always wanted his last film, his swan song, to be The Dead, and The Dead was made, I think, two years after Pritzy's Honor.
Yes, exactly. And I haven't seen The Dead either, but I have been revisiting, you know, some of the later Huston films like Fat City, Reflections in a Golden Eye, and he also did The Man Who Would Be King in there, and obviously Pritzy's Honor is one of these later films, and I think he had a rep at a certain point that where he was sort of in decline, but I think if you looking at a lot of the later Huston films, they're very wise and very insightful about humanity and about people and not all of them. I mean, I think there are probably some duds in there, but you know, at the same time, there's just something about them that even I would suspect, you know, with Pritzy's Honor, even with its comic tone, that from what I've read, and we actually had one of our writers at the house give us his appreciation piece on Pritzy's Honor.
Yeah.
We're basically like, you know, he finds it eminently quotable and a great comedy, but it's clear that there's something deeper about it to him that just, you know, that hits him on, and that just makes sense to me with these with a lot of these later Houston films.
It is very sharp. It's very sharp. It's very colorful and funny. But you're right. There is a melancholy. In the film that settles in. And it's a great tour de force by Nicholson.
Yeah, and I have no doubt about that. I mean, you know,
Jack
at this time, I mean, was probably doing a lot of his best work, and and especially like the '80s is often thought of as a cultural wasteland, but I think there's little gems you find all around it, you know, and I'm constantly finding little gems around there, even within some movies that I'm not all that crazy about. But at the same time, I mean, you know, it's even great to think of like Houston working within that period and kind of giving us these things that I think, you know, as I think the guy Edward Copeland, who wrote the piece on House, pointed out, Houston wasn't really acknowledged with awards. He got some awards nominations, but, you know, Pritzi's Honor didn't really sweep many of them. You know, they gave it to kind of more obvious things.
Mm-hmm. Angelica Houston, I think, was the winner that year for that.
Yeah, but, you know, Houston did win, so... you know, I mean, at the same time, it's nice that this man who kind of started in the studio system, you know, was able to make such rich work even up through what a lot of people consider the doldrums. So
it really is, and I know that people compared it to like a kind of comedic take on The Godfather, but you can even see
Godfather
some kind of...
No, sorry, wrong film.
You can kind of see a little Sopranos in it, you know, and it is very rich, like The Godfather is. You feel the family history in the film. And William Hickey, I mean, I remember people looked at William Hickey after that movie and they said, oh, my God, this is where did he come from? It was like an 80-year-old guy and he was the new discovery. Okay, let's that was June 14th. June 21st saw a Return to Oz.
Oh, that movie. Oh, God.
And actually, Sam Raimi is returning again to Oz.
Everyone's returning to Oz.
Walter Murch did it definitively. That movie is so underrated, and it needs to be like shouted from the rooftops how great that film is. It's astonishing, I think. So
I gave you the wrong movie then. Is that available? I mean, is it easily available?
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's on DVD, and I mean that captures the spirit of the Oz book so brilliantly. And I mean, God, the stop motion work in that is just incredible. And Fairuza Balk, like she's awesome as Dorothy, and
it
makes amazing use of Henson puppets and everything like that. I think Brian Henson plays Jack Pumpkinhead. The scene with the witch and all the different heads that she can exchange onto her body. I mean, that movie is just so incredibly perverse. It's exactly what I think children's entertainment should be, in the sense of, you know, it should scare children. You know, children should be scared, you know, in some ways, but in a way, you know, but it's done in a way that is, I guess maybe the point is that movie is so unique, in what it does that it couldn't be recaptured. And I mean, that actually is something where I have to give George Lucas props, because he kept Murch on that film, you know, because Murch was on the verge of being fired, and Lucas, I believe, just came in and said, you know, I will guarantee that this man can finish it. And, you know, Lucas did two great things that year. He saved Walter. He kept Walter Murch on Return to Oz, and he co-produced Mishima by Paul Schrader. And you know, whatever he did, you know, before or after, and he did a lot of ruinous things, I think, quite frankly, you know, I give him eternal thanks for those two things at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
I guess then there's Howard the Duck, but hey, what are you gonna do?
What can you do? You didn't ask Gullia Thompson about Howard the Duck.
No, I didn't.
That's my Return to Oz thing. So
Return to Oz is the one that we all need to look up again. That's the gem from that summer that we all need to revisit.
No,
also from June 21st, Life Force, which you can read an article on Life Force at that time.
I love Life Force.
Yeah.
Toby Hooper.
Our writers did not, but.
I do. I just love it. There's a chaos that I love about it.
Yeah, our writers.
There was a definite chaos to Toby Hooper at that time, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think they call it Blow, but anyways.
Also June 21st, a movie that we covered with Steve Guttenberg last week. And Aaron, what are your thoughts on Cocoon?
Cocoon. And this is going to be my last film because I do have to duck out here. But Cocoon.
You do?
I do have to duck out. I'm sorry.
Really?
Yeah, I do. Something has come up. But I will say about Cocoon, not to short shrift y'all, Ron Howard. Cocoon, I'm a Ron Howard defender. I've actually talked to Matt about I've wanted to do a video essay series defending Ron Howard. I think he's vastly underrated. I think because he's not flashy, if you will, he kind of gets dismissed as a filmmaker. But when it comes to ensembles, he's pretty remarkable. Stuff like Apollo 13 and Backdraft and
mm-hmm.
Parenthood and so forth. Cocoon is one of, I guess this is his first real ensemble film. And as an ensemble piece, it is interesting. It is heartwarming. I'm not crazy about it as a story. It's just a little too touchy-feely. And mainly, and frankly, because of coming off of Night Shift and Splash, which I think are terrific 80s comedies, I was a little disappointed that, you know, Ron Howard kind of went the soft and fuzzy Spielberg route. And I do think the performances are uniformly good. It's just not a film that I connect to in any meaningful way. But Ron Howard is a vastly underrated filmmaker. And so his filmmaking in Cocoon, as absurd as it is very good. It's just I don't connect with the story the way I do. Something like Night Shift or Apollo 13, or even his follow-up film, which is Gung Ho, which is also...
Oh, I like that film. That's a good film.
An underrated film.
Yeah. All right, Aaron. Well, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Aaron.
Keith, always a pleasure, my man. I hope to see you soon.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. thank you, buddy. Thank you, Vandy. the remainder of June, June 28th, saw Red Sonja. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Brigitte Nielsen, the only person of the opposite sex more built than Arnold Schwarzenegger. Pale Rider, the mythic Clint Eastwood Western, and St. Elmo's Fire, which we discussed with Schumacher and between you and I last week, Jerry. So let's go to July 3rd and a movie that you wanted to cover, Jerry. There, of course, was Back to the Future that day and Day of the Dead. But there is also The Emerald Forest, John Borman.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, that week, the following weekend, because I went to see it with, you know, some friends, and then I went and took my mom and my brother to see it the next day, and I really liked it a lot. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I had, I don't know if I've ever said this on a show, but there's a ongoing favorite film of mine that never goes out of style, and that's Excalibur. It just left a vivid impression on me. I know I've talked about it probably on the show once or twice. I just, as I've gotten older, the reason I like the film is, and it's going to sound really crazy on my part, everyone gets what they deserve in the film. I know that sounds weird, but if you watch the film and you've seen my take on, like, The Godfather and everything, yeah, everyone gets what they deserve in Excalibur. I mean, the people I like get what they deserve, and the people I don't like get what they deserve. But I always liked John Borman. I stayed up late one night and watched Zardoz. And that summer, we watched The Emerald Forest a couple times, and I went back and we rented Deliverance.
Right.
And that's not...
Talking about getting what you deserve.
Yeah, that's a film that really... I had never seen it before. My mom was telling me about it and says, you know, you should watch Deliverance. Because that's, you know, considered one of his best films. And I think I'd only seen Hell in the Pacific, and I hadn't seen it. It'll be many years before I watched Point Blank. But Emerald Forest is just amazing.
The plot of it is, to recap the plot just quickly.
Okay, They're Powers Booth in what I think is probably his best performance. His young son is kidnapped by one of the tribes in the Amazon rainforest, and he goes back to years later to look for his son, finds him. It's Charlie Borman plays the son, and it helps to have the director's last name to be in the film. And I guess he's really famous now for being Ewan McGregor's friend in their motorcycle journeys or whatever on one of those reality shows. But it's a beautiful film. It's just a beautiful film, and it was one of the first films I remember that dealt with the destruction of the Amazon rainforest.
Right, right, right.
And there's a great line, and it's just a little line, and I talk about these little things I pick up in films, but when Powers Booth is going back to look for his son, the guy on the boat's like, you know, this is, you can smell the oxygen when they're in the rain, like the heart of the rainforest. I'm like, wow, that's a potent line.
Yeah.
But there's just a lot of, it's a beautiful film. There's a rhythm about it I love, and I know, and people tell me, you know, I tell people years later I like the film, they look at me like, oh, dude, the film doesn't hold up at all. I haven't seen the film in a long time, so I don't know.
I haven't either. I remember that it was very, people were very divisive on it.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
I think my brother, my mom and my brother were not, when I took them to see it the second time, they were not crazy about it. So
today, it's not really a movie that you'd see today being released 4th of July weekend.
No, I don't. You know where it'd be released?
Yeah.
It'd be released at the IFC Theater in New York.
Right.
It'd
be on demand.
On demand. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. And this got a major release opposite Back to the Future on a 4th of July weekend, 1985. Okay, Keith. The next week, July 10th. We're going to talk about two movies from this week, and you get the first one. Here's a trailer.
The world had been through a trial by fire, and only the greatest warriors and their deadliest enemies emerged from the flames.
Who are you?
Nobody.
Oh, mister, I can feel it. The dice are rolling.
He was the one they called Mad.
But he's just a raggedy man.
But to those whose lives hung in the balance...
What's the warning, Watts?
Waiting for what?
Waiting for you.
He was the one they called hero.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dying time's here.
Now, Mad Max is back in Beyond Thunderdome. Mel Gibson, Tina Turner, Mad Max, Beyond Thunderdome.
And I do remember that being like the oddball casting coup that summer, Tina Turner.
Yeah, Tina Turner, yeah.
Have you seen this, Keith?
Oh, hell yeah, of course I have. No, Master Blaster and the Anti-Entity and all that. Yeah, I mean, of course. And we don't need another hero. I mean, you know, it's quintessential 80s in so many ways, and yet also very George Miller, of course, in its own way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. You're right.
What's interesting about this one, I think, is that it seems to be the odd one out among the Mad Max trilogy as we get further along. It's kind of like, you know, I was always kind of shocked when people kept saying, like, things like, Return of the Jedi sucks, you know, and all this. And I was like, really?
I feel the same. I know where you're going with this.
It never made sense to me. And, of course, it seems that Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome has sort of that rep. It's kind of like it's the Road Warriors, The Empire Strikes Back, and the Return of the Jedi, and you know, and maybe it's because the kids are like the Ewoks or something. I don't know. I know,
but the they're really not, though.
Yeah, I know. And the kids never really bothered me here. And as I'm thinking back on Beyond Thunderdome, which I haven't seen in a long time, I mean, I remember, isn't it like they take the 747, and they find the 747, and they fly to the new city or something.
You really haven't seen it in a long time.
I don't even know. It's like, but the ending, I'm just thinking of like where We Don't Need Another Hero is playing and all this. And,
well, they do find the plane in the sand, don't they?
Yeah,
they do find a plane, and but there's like the God. This shows you. There's the kids that stay behind, and then there are the kids that go to Bartertown, and those are the kids that Max, you know, reluctantly has to go save. So you have these two tribes. The criticism of this film at the time was it was two different films. When Max is exiled from Bartertown and meets up with the kids, it becomes like Lord of the Flies. And that actually has one of the I love the sequence where they tell the tale about where they think he's Captain Walker, and they say a tribe called Turbulence, and there's all these like beautiful lyrical lines spoken about how they came to be, and the Maurice Gerard score is beautiful. To the film, it was very different from Brian May's scores to the first two films, and I have a very soft place in my heart for this film. Keith's analogy to Return of the Jedi is very true. People who loved the first two Mad Max films hated this film.
I do recall going to see it and coming out of it and thinking, man, that's exciting filmmaking. Just the centerpiece of all the films, which is the last 20-minute car chase in every film, just gets more and more astounding.
Mm-hmm.
And the Master Blaster scene, in the cage, and
Thunderdome,
You know, as far as Miller's filmography, it probably has a lot of corollary with Babe Taking the City, which is also widely reviled, and which I think is a genius piece.
Why is that one reviled? It was so, because it was dark?
You know, for the same reason that I think Return to Oz is reviled, because it actually does scare people, you know, and it's like, but I mean, you know, things pretty much work out, but it confronts, like, really upsetting issues in what is ostensibly a children's entertainment, and you know, I mean, I'm sort of against, like, trying to categorize things. Like, let's make a children's entertainment. No, let's just make a good movie with, like, imagination. And George Miller is imagination to spare.
Yeah.
And, you know, his movies are, even the ones I'm not all that crazy about, I'm not that crazy about Happy Feet, but I think Happy Feet has that incredible sequence in the, when he ends up in the zoo. We're basically, like, the humans are actual humans in this animated world, and it's so creepy. It's an extremely creepy effect, but that's like, that's what like Miller can do, you know. And I feel like though that Beyond Thunderdome kind of has that affinity with Babe Taking the City in that way.
You're right.
So it is just so crazy, and it's kind of like, you know, I guess maybe Rogue Warrior is just like so perfectly streamlined that when Miller goes crazy and a bit more, you know, he reaches for so many things, and maybe he doesn't get everything, but I mean, it's just like so incredible where the man's mind can go. And I think that's just kind of what Beyond Thunderdome, you know, gives you.
Let me see. I think we have, we might have Dean on the phone. Let me see. Dean, are you on the phone?
Yes, I'm down here on the street.
Can you stop hooking for a second and do you want to sit in an Aaron's place as long as your phone lasts? Then Dean, I'll give you the next movie, okay?
All right.
Let's try this out. Keith, this is Dean. This is a loyal listener, Dean.
Hello, Dean. Hi.
Okay. Keith, here's your movie.
Columbia TriStar Home Video presents the movie that brought a new brand of adventure to the Old West. Silverado.
I'm going to enjoy this.
Kevin Kline, Scott Glenn, Rosanna Arquette, John Cleese, Kevin Costner, Brian Dennehy, Danny Glover, and Jeff Goldblum.
I don't want to kill you, and you don't want to be dead.
In a Lawrence Kasdan film.
I told you to practice my horse, not me.
The rousing epic that blazed a new frontier and brought the Western back in style.
All right, Silverado, released on July 10th.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a valiant effort. I felt like I feel like Silverado is kind of half of a good movie. You know, it's like it has individual scenes that are livened up by people like John Cleese and Linda Hunt. And I really think, actually, the thing that I remember most about Silverado was that even now, looking back on it now, I think it might have Kevin Costner's most lively performance.
I think so, too. I miss that Kevin Costner. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't think we've seen anything close to that Kevin Costner since then.
The closest the closest he's come in recent years is Tin Cup and The Upside of Anger. Yeah,
that's right.
But he's so energetic in that movie and very physical and doesn't seem to have that kind of pall over his persona that he's kind
yeah.
of, you know.
There's no brooding.
No, there's no brooding, and I think it's you know, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I just remember that it kind of starts and stops, and it's kind of just sort of like a half of a. It's kind of a real missed opportunity. But there are some really good things. Like I think the photography and the costuming, and is that Alan Silvestri who did that score?
Bruce Broughton, yeah. One of the great scores of that year. I love that score to Silverado.
Yeah, really terrific score in it, and it does a lot of work in rousing things.
Okay. So Jerry, I'm going to give you a special gift. I'm going to name the remaining movies that came out in July, because there's a movie in August that I know we're going to talk a lot about in this last half hour. And you tell me which one stands out that you want to say something about.
Okay, sure, whatever.
July 12th, Explorers. July 19th, The Coca-Cola Kid, The Legend of Billie Jean, and Weatherby, and The Man with One Red Shoe. July 24th, The Black Cauldron. July 26th, National Lampoon's European Vacation, A Thousand Little Kisses, The Heavenly Kid, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and Kiss of the Spider Woman.
Wow, you give me some to work with, not a lot there, but the Coca-Cola Kid was good. I remember watching the Coca-Cola Kid. European Vacation was silly, fun. I remember watching that. Explorers, I just watched again. That was the one I watched, actually, all the way through. First half is great. Now I remember why I didn't like the second half. The aliens just really bored the hell out of me.
That's exactly it.
The first half I thought was wonderful. I mean,
yeah, when they're putting everything together, it's really terrific.
And James Cromwell.
Yeah.
I mean, the other play, the other film where he's a nice guy. I mean, you know, that and Babe. Speaking of Babe, I mean, and I guess you could say he's kind of nice in 6 Feet Under. All right, but Kiss of the Spider Woman. Obviously, we didn't know at the time, but any movie with Raul Julia
is a treasure.
Is a treasure.
You know,
and that's
another thing. In the summer, like I've expressed, of mostly dumbed down crap, dreck, you have something like Pritzi's Honor, The Emerald Forest, Kiss of the Spider Woman. Which has really gained in reverence over the years, too. I mean, it was really critically praised at its opening. But every interview I hear of William Hurt, obviously he won the Oscar for it, but he's asked about it. He had a harrowing experience. He was actually kidnapped at gunpoint when he was shooting Kiss of the Spider-Woman. He and a female friend. That's an interesting story. Yeah, listen to NPR if you want to hear that. But brave stuff. And it also reminds me of Hector Babenco. Where did he go? I mean, I know he did Outplay in the Fields of the Lord. I know he did Ironweed, which I always kind of enjoy. Well, didn't enjoy, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, too.
Where's Hector Babenco?
He has disappeared. He has completely disappeared. That's a shame. I think Peashoot is one of the great movies. He has completely disappeared. It's kind of a shame. My main thing about Kiss of the Spider Woman is still Raul Julia. I mean, I still feel like, and I'm not saying that as 2020 hindsight or whatever, but I feel like it's Raul Julia's movie, and I always thought it was really strange that he wasn't even nominated for the Oscar that year.
He did a movie I saw, a Brazilian movie, actually a while. I had to go look it up on IMDb, but Karen Daru, a Brazilian prison movie, that's
right.
Superb. But that was in 2003, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Babenco?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Keith, you have any? I'm sorry, Keith. I was going to ask you. You have any thoughts on any of those movies?
You know, I think again we're getting into a lot of blind spots for me. I've never seen Kiss of the Spider Woman, and you know. I don't have anything to add, sad to say, at this point.
I have one thing to add. Even though I despised National Lampoon's European Vacation, I do have to say that it has one sight gag in it that made me laugh harder than almost anything that summer, which was, there was a scene when they're up on, the whole family's up on the Eiffel Tower, and somebody has a beret or something, and they throw the beret off, and there's a little dog that jumps off and catches the beret like it's a frisbee, and you see it from really far away, and he catches it in midair as he's falling. It was the funniest thing. That summer for me.
Yeah.
I mean, so, Pee-wee notwithstanding, of course.
Yeah,
right.
Pee-wee was, great.
Yeah, European Vacation was a seminal film for me.
It was fun. I mean, as fun as for a 14-year-old.
Also The Man with One Red Shoe, which was one of two summer movies that Tom Hanks had. The second he had in August changed his life. It was called Volunteers, which was another John Candy movie, but it changed his life because that's where he met his wife. He always says that's his favorite movie, Volunteers, because of that.
Mm-hmm.
The Black Cauldron is kind of an interesting movie in terms of Disney history, because it kind of effectively killed the Disney animation machine for a few years, and actually sent Don Bluth out of the Disney realm, and where he went on to do Secret of Nim, and and all those.
Right.
The dinosaur movie and all that.
And he also did movies that he had Barry Manilow compose. That's an interesting trivia point. Thumbelina and
was always shocked the Black Cauldron didn't do well, because it was so popular. You know, the book and everything was so popular, and I was always shocked that like came and went so quickly.
It seems like it's another one of those movies like Return to Oz that might have been a little too dark for the family audience at that point. And I definitely, by the way, definitely trumpet Return to Oz as one of the unsung movies of that summer. I mean, it's definitely something that people need to go back and check out.
I mean Harlan Ellison actually in his film criticism book wrote a really beautiful defense of the film. And that was at the time too. I think he was one of the few voices that basically said, this is something that you really have to pay attention to.
Are you being arrested, Dean? Should I worry?
Dean, what's going on there, man?
It's Brooklyn. You're going to hear sirens going by.
All right. August 2nd, Sesame Street presents Follow That Bird.
Which I would like to actually see. I'm kind of interested.
I had a lot of SCTV cast in it. From what I remember,
which I can talk about, because that also is a seminal movie of my childhood, seen on videotape mainly, I just published an essay about it on The House by a new contributor, D.W. Gardner, and I think he captured a lot of what the effect of that was, which is essentially that it's kind of dealing with Big Bird as being this big child, essentially, who's told that you can't live with these diverse group of people, you have to be with your own kind, and then sort of being like, a journey back to that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The scene I remember from that is where Big Bird, and actually the writer didn't really make note of this, he said the second half was kind of weaker, but the scene I always remember is where Big Bird is unveiled in this carnival in a cage, and he's painted blue, and he sings this really sad song about being blue and everything. So it's, it's, and just as a child, I remember that just really upsetting
mm-hmm.
and everything. And then of course, they ultimately escape, and I think there's a whole, plane chase sequence and everything like that. it all works out, but, that movie, too, kind of has this edge to it. And funny, directed by Ken Kwapis, who would go on to make the Faye Dunaway chimp movie, Dunstan Checks In.
And is also directing episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm these days.
Also, excuse me.
Also from August 2nd, Weird Science, which we've talked about before in the show in relation to John Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big teenage wish fulfillment.
That was cool.
I think people remember it most for Bill Paxton nowadays.
Definitely.
But on August 2nd, Carl with a K in our chat room wanted to make sure that we covered this movie. So here's a clip from this movie that also came out that day.
What would you do if you accidentally discovered the house next door was occupied by something not human? Something horrifying. Something unspeakably evil. No one believes you.
Mom, I didn't have a nightmare.
Not your mom.
They did kill a girl over there.
Not your girlfriend.
Charlie, is this some sort of a trick to get me back?
Not even the police.
Look, I know it's crazy. I know that, but look, Lieutenant!
It knows that you know. You'll do anything to protect yourself. But it will do anything to protect its secret. Fright Night. If you love being scared, this could be the night of your life.
Notable now, because they're remaking it with Colin Farrell in the Chris Sarandon role. It's been in the news lately because of that. Fright Night, I always found it a very entertaining comedic scare picture, you know?
Yeah.
And you could tell they're having a ball doing it. Roddy McDowell and Chris Sarandon, and you can tell it was a fun shoot, and that translates into the viewing experience, which it doesn't always.
I agree. I think that's a worthy of its cult status, and I remember coming out of that movie thinking Roddy McDowell is so great in this movie. I just thought he was superb in that movie. I thought he was going to get an Oscar nomination, but now it sounds strange to say that. He's my main memory of that film.
The Oscar nominated Fright Night.
He was good though.
Weird things have happened.
Yeah. Norbit got Oscar nominated. So
yeah.
Fright Night, definitely a popular film from that summer, and one that resonates today. And we'll see how Colin Farrell does. That casting excited me though.
No, it is very inspired casting.
Yeah. There's vampires in Ireland. Real Genius came out August 7th. Talk about another cult movie.
Mm-hmm.
Are they getting around to remaking that too, or is it that?
I'm sure they're
going to remake everything. I mean,
yeah.
They won't
remake Kiss of the Spider Woman though.
No, you honestly say this, and I actually just chime in on that though, because we were talking about Raul Julia, and you don't see someone like that a lot. And I have to bring him up because in the movie Tequila Sunrise was the first thing I remember watching him in. He steals the movie from everybody.
Yeah, he does.
And that's an amazing skill to have. And you don't see that a lot.
Well, you just see a movie like Presumed Innocent, which on paper that role could be nothing special.
And he what he does is
he makes it specific.
Yeah,
you know, he makes it memorable.
And he's the best Gomez Adams there ever was, as far as I'm concerned. So.
He's a great Gomez Adams.
For sure, that was heaven sent for him. I mean,
it really was.
Absolutely perfect casting. In those movies in general, all of that casting was perfect.
It really was.
Okay, so Real Genius, that's a movie that's definitely survived. There's also from that weekend Summer Rental, the other John Candy film from that summer. She had three that summer. She had Brewster's Million, Summer Rental, and Volunteers, and My Science Project, and Dance
Which
with a Stranger.
I dragged my mom to see.
I kept getting My Science Project and Real Genius mixed up with my
you
mom.
You
want to
easy to do. No, but I dragged my mom to see that because we got to go see this movie. Dennis Hopper's in it.
Yeah, right.
And I'm 14 years old, but we got to go see because Dennis Hopper's in it. It's going to be funny. And my mom was like, I'm not laughing yet.
Didn't
when am I
hate
supposed
that
to
when
laugh?
You took your parents to the movies that you really were excited about and they
Oh, but my mom was
lying.
Great because we went to go see. I dragged my mom to see stuff. I'm not going to say it on the air, but I dragged her to see everything. But she took us to see stuff. Like, she used to take us, like, two summers before, we went down to see all these great French movies, The Rules of the Game, Grand Illusion, you know. So it all worked out, balanced itself out.
That's good.
Okay. August 14th, Key Exchange, which I think is the first Bryan Singer.
Key Exchange?
No, it isn't actually.
That was
Public Access or something like that?
Yes, okay.
For the first Bryan.
Yeah.
Key Exchange was a little bitty movie. It's funny, I do have a kind of a personal connection to Key Exchange because when I went to NYU, I was taught by the screenwriter. I was taught screenwriting by the screenwriter and the playwright for Key Exchange. And I remember wanting to see it back then because it had Brooke Adams in it, and I like Brooke Adams quite a bit.
Yeah,
so.
She's great.
Yeah, so but that's it's just a tiny little movie. Actually, not really that great, but anyway, moving on.
August 16th, American Flyers, which we discussed with Alexandra Paul, another Kevin Costner movie from that summer, John Badham film, Return of the Living Dead, Dan O'Bannon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Did you skip one?
There's
a movie
that
you might have skipped that I really wanted to mention as an unsung movie that I don't hear many people talking about, which is Dance with a Stranger. Have you ever?
Dance with a Stranger. That was that summer?
Yeah, that was that summer with Miranda Richardson, that was her first breakthrough. That was kind of her breakthrough movie about the last woman that was executed for murder in Britain. And that's a really, really terrific under-the-radar British movie that should be seen.
That was August 9th. Also on August 16th, The Bride, Sting.
The Bride.
The Bride what?
The Bride with Sting. Sting was in it.
And Jennifer Beals.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Wasn't that somebody like Clancy Brown
Clancy
Frankenstein?
Brown.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That's wild.
Wow.
All right.
Wow.
Volunteers also came out on that day, and another movie that I'm saving for last.
Yeah.
August 23rd, Better Off Dead, another huge cult hit that we discussed last week. Gojira.
Or really, Godzilla 1985 was what it was released as.
One of the greatest reviews of all time. I think it was on Sixty Lions or Neil Gabler on sneak previews. I'd rather see Raven Burr stomp on the buildings.
You know, I have vivid memories because it was the video craze, and I had just started into getting movie posters. So the best way for me to do that was take take their trash at video stores, you know, steal their movie posters. Mm. And I got this huge freaking Godzilla 1985 standee.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, I have no practical place to put this thing. It sat in the garage forever.
Who the hell is collecting standees now? I mean, what?
Oh, those were great, man. Oh.
Yeah, those were great, yeah.
I had a chance to get a Big Lebowski standee one time. That's the only one that I regret not getting.
Godzilla 1985 was a big video movie for me, too.
Yeah, it was for me, too, yeah.
I think I must have watched that film, like, tons of times.
But
not the, of course, not the Japanese version, the American version with the Raymond Burr inserts and
everything. Raymond Burr.
Right.
Which are so inept in so many ways.
Yes, they are.
But, I mean, but still, I remember him doing that last speech of his where he talked about Godzilla and what it means for humanity and all this. It's such a weird and I took it so seriously at the time, and then I saw it again recently. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, no, I'm with you there, Keith. I'm with you all the way there.
August 23rd, also saw Warning Sign, The Protector, and Teen Wolf, another popular Michael J. Fox.
Oh, wow, yes, Teen Wolf. Wow. I just have to say wow. That's all.
We got Keith to say wow a lot tonight.
Yeah. No,
we're really wowing him. That's great.
Yeah. No, just to bring back memories. So, yeah.
Shall we go to the elephant in the room?
The final week was August 30th, Compromising Positions. I kind of remember that movie. That was another Raul Julia, wasn't it? He played a dentist or something?
Is that, I get that mixed up with the movie with Kevin Kline and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. What was that called?
That one's the Pakula film. Consenting Adults.
Consenting Adults, sorry,
yeah.
All right.
Compromising Positions, Raul Julia and Susan Sarandon, I think, were in it.
Mm-hmm.
American Ninja and Flesh and Blood, which the first entry into the Summer of 85 articles at the House covered Flesh and Blood, the Rutger Hauer.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Paul Verhoeven, isn't it, right?
Yeah, that is Paul Verhoeven, yeah.
And Frank Frazetta, right? Frank Frazetta, didn't he do the story to it? And
I believe so, yeah.
I think you're right.
I still have the movie poster for that. It's the only movie poster I have that has Frazetta's art on it.
Okay, in the last 15 minutes here, this is the last movie that we wanted to cover. It opened August 16th, and I know at least for Jerry and myself, it means a lot to us.
And me too.
I'm waiting until I can get to the switchboard page so I can play this clip. Okay, there it is. There's the switchboard page. Not a moment too soon. Here's a trailer.
Commander of the 5th Precinct and the most decorated cop in New York City has declared war on Chinatown.
I got a complaint about you already.
Today there were 43 gang arrests, 3 gambling parlors raided, 6 sweatshops busted.
You're only meant to shake up the gang kids.
And now, an opening blow at the man who's been called the godfather of Chinatown, Joey Tai. Mr. Tai, can you tell us if there is such a thing as the Chinese Mafia? Mr. Tai, what is your comment? Mr. Tai, do you have any comments?
Let me make this real clear to you right here and now. Joey Tai goes to the mayor goes to me, and the word is lay off. You think gambling, extortion, corruption are kosher? We're Chinese mafia. The investigation's in your mind. These people are the biggest importers of heroin in this country. The point here is you cease and desist. Nobody wants to win this thing, do you?
You don't like it? Resign.
Maybe everybody's right. I'm chasing something that doesn't exist.
This is not the Bronx or Brooklyn. Not even New York. Chinatown, White. It can be very easy, or it can be very hard.
You care too much, Stanley. How can anybody care too much?
Okay, Year of the Dragon, Michael Cimino, Mickey Rourke. Did you see this in the theater, Jerry?
Yes, I did. The fight broke out halfway through it. But
I saw the theater,
film.
Too.
I
saw the theater,
it
too.
Yeah.
I think this is his best performance, and I love Barfly. I love Pope of Greenwich Village. I love The Wrestler. But this is my all-time favorite Rourke performance.
Well, it's definitely his best lead performance, I think. Although I would go with best performance for Diner, but I think it's definitely his best lead performance.
You know what? Sure. I never look at a thing of popcorn the same way after seeing Diner. So, but I'm serious when I say that. I never really think of popcorn.
It's true, but it always pops into your mind. So
yes,
to speak.
It pops.
They're a good fit. Cimino and Rourke, obviously, and they like each other enormously.
Mm-hmm.
They still do.
Also, written by Oliver Stone, right?
Yes.
Right.
We actually spoke to Raymond J. Berry, who's in the movie, a couple of years ago.
He's great.
And he talked about the macho-ness of that set.
Yeah.
It was inescapable. And it's kind of, when I think of Mickey Rourke, I always have thought of him in relation to this movie and what he represents to me, his power as an actor. Extremely male, strong, macho, and at the same time, not afraid to be vulnerable and highly emotional. He's in that tradition of those great, powerful actors that can show such range of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think of when his wife was killed in
Year
of the Dragon.
Those are the, I think his scenes with, the wife, and that actress's name escapes
me
at the moment.
Carolyn.
And she's great in it. She only has one or two scenes in it. But his scenes with her are really the hook that gets you into that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all the vulnerability that's there. I mean, it's such a great. Raymond J. Berry is terrific in it too. I mean, he is really good in it as well.
Now, Keith, I'm interested to hear what you think of it and what your thoughts on Cimino are in general too.
Okay. Well, first of all, you found another blind spot because I haven't seen.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
This is your Return to Oz. Like
to
Oz is ours that we have to look up and.
Yeah. But I can give some thoughts on Cimino. I feel like in some ways at this point he's probably a subject for further research because Heaven's Gate so annoyed me when I saw it a few years ago, and The Deer Hunter I just never really quite got into. But he's such a strange and interesting figure that I feel like he's someone who, even the films that, have annoyed me, I want to get into Heaven's Gate. I want to get into Deer Hunter. So I feel like I want to wait. I feel like maybe even the time is now to kind of revisit some of these films, maybe within the context of seeing, like, Year of the Dragon and some of the other ones that he's done. Was his last one, what was it? God. Sun Chaser, right, and everything. He doesn't have very much either. You know, he's got like Thunderbolt and like Up Through the Sun Chaser, and he has something in.
He wrote Magnum Force with Milius, I think.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and so I mean, you know, there's that too. And I honestly feel like that's one of the weaker Dirty Harry films, frankly. But I mean, nonetheless, I mean, I feel like he's someone I want to get into, and I've had trouble, and but I'm not ready to like write him off yet. Because
he's interesting because he is one of those directors that have to be grappled with. And he's more infamous. I think he has infamy. He's not known as one of our great directors, but he is infamous for a variety of reasons that culminated in the Heaven's Gate experience. I think there's a reassessment happening on Heaven's Gate.
Yeah,
people at least see Heaven's Gate as a thing of beauty. I mean,
yeah,
it's not the dud
that it once was thought of.
And you know what might have re-stoked my interest, funny enough, was, have you seen the Christopher Walken video where he's on the English talk show and he's doing the lyrics to Lady Gaga's Poker Face.
I've heard about it.
And basically there's a guy online who basically took the Cartman version of Poker Face from South Park and the Lady Gaga version of Poker Face and cut them all together and made a music video out of it.
Cool.
And they use a scene, when she says the lyric Russian roulette isn't as fun without a gun or something like that, they intercut scenes of the Deer Hunter. Of walking, putting the gun to his head and like shooting and nothing coming out. Like, you know, and then you have him in the present day going, poker face, my poker face. It's like, I was like, I should really revisit the Deer Hunters.
You know, but
there's
the sense too that he sets out to make an epic. I mean, he sets out. I can almost see him brazenly saying something like, you know, yeah, let me take on an apocalypse now each time out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a definite. I think there's an ego to being a filmmaker anyway. I mean, just the fact that you are making a movie and you expect people to watch it, but. But I especially feel that ego with him, and that's why I'm so curious where he is now,
mm-hmm.
in his mindset, in his feeling about the art, and his contribution.
He's a woman, right?
You know,
no. Well, he certainly looks like it, but I don't think he is.
You know, I just watched a documentary about the Heaven's Gate debacle, and
it's a great documentary. That Final Cut thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
Beautiful.
And you know, they talked about his background as an advertising, as a director of commercials, and how even his commercials were writ large. You know, even though they were done for television, obviously. But and how he went even over budget on commercials, but that was okay because they were commercials. But here, the thing about Cimino to me is I really, at least with those first three movies, and particularly with the first two, I'm talking about Deer Hunter and Heaven's Gate. They're really big screen movies. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I really
feel
like, particularly Heaven's Gate, I know your ass is going to be hurting after three and almost 4 hours, but I've seen it on the big screen, and it's a much, much different movie. It's a radically, radically different movie than watching it scrunched on some screen that you're watching. I don't care if it's even a big screen. Watching it on film projected, just like with Deer Hunter and with, I would venture to say, Year of the Dragon, they become ridiculously huge and quite moving, but and very operatic. I mean,
that's what I like about him. I like the opera in his films.
Mm-hmm.
That feeling it's so heightened. And there's outside of the moments after his wife dies, the shot that always gets me about Year of the Dragon. It's the first image that flashes in my mind every time I think of the movie, is when he chases the two females, and he shoots one of them, and they land in the street, and then it cuts to a wider shot where you see down the New York street, and you see the Manhattan in the background,
mm-hmm.
and he's standing above her with the gun, and he's saying, "You're gonna die, sweetheart."
Yeah,
and it's just a moment where, oh, that's the uber cool.
That movie, I do have two big beefs with Year of the Dragon that's easily overcome. Number one, I hate the leading lady, which is named her name is Ariane. She completely disappeared, and she gives a strangely wooden performance in it that I just don't understand why that was let by. And second, this is more minor, but it did distract me from the movie. And tell me if you guys noticed this, too.
It sounds like a scene from Year of the Dragon in the background.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of like that. But it's Mickey Rourke's hair keeps changing color.
Yeah, my mom always says that when talking about the movie. The hair changes color constantly.
Why was that let go? You know, I mean, it's radically changed, you know, from scene to scene. And I just, that's something that just mystifies me. this
Well, there's
day.
Something. There's something with Cimino. I can't speak to the hair, but you see it in the Final Cut documentary. The leading lady that he wanted, and everyone said no. There's something about him when he has his mind set on something. There's a stubbornness that even if he's wrong, he probably won't admit it. I think he probably felt that he was wrong about his leading lady in Year of the Dragon, and it was too late to admit and too ego-bruising to admit it. That could be it.
Yes, I think that's a good theory, and I'm sure that after the Heaven's Gate thing, he was kind of covering his ass a little bit, you know. And
he showed up at Cannes 3 years ago, I think, and he was photographed and looking very frail and thin and gaunt, and he had a young model, supermodel, on his arm, and they interviewed him, and he said, "Look, I've written many scripts. I can't get anything done." He still has the fire, I guess, and the creative instinct.
But he also has the Scarlet Letter, so it's like, we haven't mentioned John Lone, how great John Lone is in the movie.
He was excellent in that.
He's superb in it. I remember seeing that and seeing Iceman, which was John Lone's first movie, where he plays a caveman that gets... Gets recovered.
It's a good movie. I recall Pauline Kael raving about Iceman.
And my mother loved that film a lot,
It was a big cable favorite for me. Every time it came on cable, I had to stop and watch it because I found the photography and the score by Bruce Boughton again and John Lone so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And something about the art direction of it too was great. And that's another movie that deserves to be rediscovered, I think.
So Keith, you first of all, check out Year of the Dragon, and I'll check out Return to Oz. That's our pact.
This show has really shown me to be woefully deficient in 1985 films. So
this has been great. But you've taken part in 84. Were you part of our 83? I can't remember two years ago.
Yeah, he was.
And many other shows, of course. But you're part of our family, especially when it comes to these podcasts here. So looking at the summer of 85 compared to the other two that we've covered. What do you think?
You know, I feel like 83 and 84 were a bit richer. It just in terms of my own experience. But at the same time, I almost feel like I want to do a Cimino thing. I feel like I probably need a bit more of a grasp on it in order to before I really give a final judgment. Because
and definitely Percy's honor.
As we can see, I definitely have a lot of blind spots here, it's weird. I don't quite know why that is, you know. And I am one who goes around saying that we should really kind of try to reevaluate some of the '80s because I think it just has the stigma of being a cultural wasteland.
Right.
And you know, maybe not without. There's probably some truth in that. At the same time, I think that looking at some of these things now with a bit more hindsight, you probably find some riches where you didn't expect it, and maybe the riches you found at the time, would not look so good now. You know, that's just the nature of the movies. They change, you know, as time goes on, and you just have to sort of, you know, figure it out as you go along. You know, where you stand with them. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I find, and talk to Jerry about this, as we go along in the summers of the 80s decade, there are worthy movies to discuss, but it becomes fewer and fewer as we get into the 90s, oddly enough. So, I'll post the question to you, Keith, because I've already talked to Jerry about this.
Yeah.
Looking at this summer, 25 years from now, anything to talk about? I mean,
well, I'm one of the few Survival of the Dead fans out there, so that would be something that I would defend, you know, and that's an unpopular choice.
I can think of one movie.
I'm just looking quickly at like the things that I've. I mean, you know, there are things that I'm not all that crazy about that are getting released, though, now. Like, there's the documentary Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. There's
That's really good. I like that.
There's Alain Resnais's movie Wild Grass, which was made in 2009, but which is getting a release now. I mean, I think part of the thing we're going to find, though, is that the release patterns between what 85 was and what 2010 is are very different in terms of what gets seen,
that's
where
it
gets seen and everything. And so, you know, I'm mentioning a lot of these films here, but, you know, like, Wild Grass is not going to get released in the middle of the country or anything like that. At least I don't think so. You know, or anywhere, like, wide in that sense. Or
even Winter's Bone or whatever, probably.
Yeah, Winter's Bone isn't going to get a wide release.
Winter's Bone, you know, you're dealing with that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what this is telling us is that the idea of the summer blockbuster has its time, and I'm practically all for letting that model go and moving on to something else, frankly, because I think, you know, it was a sort of Spielberg created model in its own way. It's not solely responsible for it, but
Jaws,
you know, was like one of the first big ones, and so it created this kind of thing that really came to fruition in the 80s, you know, just because that's where America was. And now I think we're kind of moving away from that. We're really getting to a point where it's like, you know, big tentpole things, and then you have to look around for all these, you know, smaller things.
Yeah.
I think honestly there are probably a lot more there are a lot of riches now too, but you have to look in different places.
Yeah.
Well, there are different venues now. I mean, you can find them on your TV the same day they open New York and
the
LA.
One that I think of is this, I think I talked about this show, the Father of My Children, a French movie.
Right.
That would be the one I would take away recently.
Right, and I mean,
but 25 years from now, we're looking at a calendar. We're probably not going to find those as releases. I mean, like, I'm looking at a calendar as I go through this roundtable here today. Kiss of the Spider Woman would not open wide.
No.
No, but but I also look at something like that as Kiss of the Spider Woman wouldn't be made now because it was made in 85, and, you know, and that's okay, you know, because there are things that are being made now that are reflect this time, and they might not be immediately apparent. They might not be immediately apparent, but they eventually will be, you know, and you just have to keep looking and seeing, and this is why I'm saying we should even, like, revisit the 80s and the summer of the 80s and see how some of these things are playing now, because it's not just a drop in the bucket and you leave it there. You know, it's an ever-evolving thing.
Well, it's another piece of news that came out, I think, yesterday, which was unusual and kind of hopeful for me. Studios are saying that the sequels don't work, and so they're actually requesting more original content.
Good.
They're requesting originality.
I hope so.
Well, I mean, it's not the first time that's happened. I mean, you know, that's
no, everything's cyclical, but
I mean, you know, there's, you know, I remember hearing that same story, you know, 3 years ago.
Yeah, well, let's see.
And,
you know, if Eclipse does well, you know, you have Eclipse, and you know, you have Toy Story 3, and you know, if those things are huge.
Yeah, they'll suffer amnesia from what they said last week. But,
Absolutely. You know, it's just, you know, just like what William Goldman said, nobody knows anything.
No,
so
they don't.
Everybody's always flying blind in Hollywood until something hits, and then they just want to reproduce it.
Let me take one call before we leave.
Okay.
864 area code.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
How you doing, man?
Well, I've been looking at old 80s movies and trying to get ideas. And, you know, John Hughes passed away like a few months ago, maybe.
Yeah, last year.
Last summer, right.
I thought it was shorter than that when time flies. But I wanted to know, how did they finance their movies back then? Because they did actually had a lot of great storytelling films with the little budget that they had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It seemed like it was more liberal then than it was now. Now that, even though there's many different avenues to make a movie more now, but you can tell they had actual funny movies. Now, you're all gonna have a genre of movies that are bad.
Yeah,
right.
Your TNA movies, your hood movies, your horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
What's your name?
Dwayne. I'm sorry. My name is Dwayne.
Dwayne, that's all right, man.
Yeah.
I appreciate you calling in. I think a big part, and we've discussed this on the show, a big part of John Hughes' legacy that we don't see so much now anymore is that tone of teen movie. Because the teen movies we get now, by and large, are extremely raunchy. And John Hughes really...
He thought
a lot of that age group, and he made movies that honored them as teenagers, as real people with real problems and issues and feelings, and
mm-hmm.
you know, they just weren't after, you know, TNA, which I was when I was a teenager. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, teenage movies are pretty. I think it just went to a point where everybody want to push the limit just for the sake of pushing the limit. That's why
yeah.
we got film industry now and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, and you're seeing that with like the 3D craze right now and everything. You know, push 3D as far as it can until it breaks.
Until it dies
like,
again. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I just feel like, well, I mean, there's all elements of that. You know, throughout cinema history, where you know trends and things that have been hits or whatever are multiplied until they basically burn out, and it's just kind of like. And even sometimes some of the imitations are kind of great in their own way, but you know, I mean, eventually, you know, those things die out, and then you move on, you know, I guess to the next thing and all that. And
yeah.
I think I just feel like the fallacy that people get into is that you know, they think that this is the end of everything. You know, like where we are is the end. You know, it can't develop any further from here. And it just seems to me what history teaches us is that these things are in a constant state of development, and
yeah.
you can't predict where it's going to go. You know, it's I've always been able to find at least 10 movies that I think are that really speak to me in a given year, and I often find more than that. So I
mm-hmm.
feel like, and I've never had a problem doing that. So it's kind of like. I'm like, all right, I don't really see the issue here.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think every year, you know, gives you 20 or 30 good movies, you know, from masterpiece to very good movies that
yeah,
are worth
seeing. Yeah, I agree with that, yeah.
Yeah. Or even things that are guilty pleasures are also mixed in there, too. That,
yeah.
I always feel like there's enough. So I don't ever feel like it's going to end, but it's just a matter. It's when you see the same stuff being churned out over and over again, it does give you pause to worry,
mm-hmm.
and you also wonder if people are reacting to the good stuff. You don't really if the really really good stuff is not being seen in theaters. You start to wonder, you're kind of like in a dark room, kind of wondering, oh, well, is anybody seeing this good stuff?
Yeah.
And if it doesn't pull in the money, then you think, well, are they going to keep making good stuff? Who knows, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I think the answer is that if you've seen it and you love it, you know, you're the one person then who goes out and starts to spread it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to give it to other people, say, hey, you know, try this one out, try this one out. And I think that makes a big difference. And you mightn't see it in the immediate, but I think that's, you know, a very important thing to do. It's one
yeah.
of the reasons I'm in criticism, and you know, I do things like chat with you guys, because I think that this gets these things out here, gets these ideas out there, and these films that we talked about that are worth it out there, and
yeah.
even resurrect some things that maybe it's time, you know, like Return to Oz. I love proselytizing.
Well, that's
Return
a very good
know.
Film to bring up right now.
Yeah, and I mean, that's just, it's the kind of, because it's the kind of, you know, kids film, quote unquote, that I'd really like people to emulate in a way without imitating.
Yeah,
right.
So,
right.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
Well, we hope we highlighted some gems from that summer and expostulated on them to inspire you guys out there to check them out if you haven't already. Dwayne, thank you for calling in, man.
Yeah, thank you, Dwayne.
Yeah,
Dean,
thanks,
thank you for filling in for Aaron.
Absolutely.
And Aaron, thank you for joining us for the first half. Keith, buddy, anytime. It doesn't have to be a theme show. I'd love you to call in.
Okay. Yeah, I will certainly do my best to keep me appraised of what you guys are doing, because I'll be there.
Cool.
Absolutely, man. We love you. Slantmagazine.com/house, and check out Keith's writing at Time Out New York.
And I should also just point out, we're going to be running the Summer of 85 series a bit longer than the 19th, because we've got a lot of submissions, actually. So
awesome. What are some future movies that you guys are writing about?
Well, tomorrow we have a David Greenwald film that I've totally forgotten the title of, but I can tell you. And it's Secret Admirer. It's actually up right now. Then we have pieces on Day of the Dead, two on Rambo First Blood Part 2, a Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, The Legend of Billie Jean is another one that's coming up. I think we're even going to get maybe a Pale Rider in there and A View to a Kill. So keep on.
Awesome.
Looking. Yeah.
Well, Dean, I'm hearing nothing but traffic.
Sorry
about that. All right, Dean. Thank you, buddy, for calling in, man.
All right, talk to you later.
All right,
bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, so check out slantmagazine.com/house for more of that writing.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.
All right, good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody. Yeah.